It's showtime.
Okay, Tokyo,
South America,
Australia,
France,
Germany,
UK,
Africa.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go, off and running for this 13th day of October 2020. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where you'll find us on the interweb tubes live at, well, usually 5 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time every Monday through Friday. A little bit late this afternoon. Had to run a, it was prescription day. That happens about the middle of the month. And so I just got back from Summersville filling scripts and That's why I'm a little bit late to the microphone. My sincere apologies. Hi, I'm Bob, and it is Trump-tanic Tuesday on the Horn. And wow, have we got a bunch of Trump-tanic intellect to share this evening. Of course, it's day two of the Amy Coney Barrett. Sham confirmation hearings, and she is at everything. Oh, I got a friend who has an ex-wife, and they didn't. It was an ugly breakup, and we were talking, and he said, "Bob, did you see? She's got crazy fill in the blank." Ex-wife eyes. And it's like, oh my God. Yeah, yeah. So we'll get into all of that, but every program here at The Horn begins with gratitude, and this program, this edition, is no different. So thanks go out to our 13th day of the month subscribers. Remember, the 13th is not the loneliest day of the month anymore, but it's pretty doggone lonely, so thank you very kindly. To John and Gary and Greg, thank you very kindly indeed for jumping in and being partial sponsors of the program via subscriptions at PayPal. Thank you very kindly indeed. If you'd like, we always need new subscribers. If you'd like to jump in, this would be a wonderful time. If you're new to the program, remember, a $10 a month subscription sets you back not quite a half of a sausage biscuit at McDonald's every day. Not even an entire half, just part of a half. That's what you're giving up. And so, again, thank you to our subscribers. Thank you to all of our a la carte contributors. Our fundraising goal for the evening, thanks to Colin jumping in the way he did last night, the fundraising goal for this evening is all of 100 and 65 bucks. 165, and we meet the fundraising goal for this Tuesday, the 13th of October 2020. And we move a little bit more, well, sort of confidently toward mid-month and keeping up with everything we have to keep up with here. So if you'd like to help out, you know, the PayPal interface is right there on the main page at headon.live. Also at HeadOn.live, as is always the case, the link to the Merry Wacky Zany real-time multimedia extravaganza that is the Horn chat room. If you pick yourself out a screen name and a password and jump in, If you never have before, that'd be a new one. But if you haven't been there in a while, come on by. And you'll be greeted by early arrivers Anatole and Bill and Jimmy and Oregon Larry and Otto and Ralps and Roger and Squeaky and Stockton Larry. Multiple Larrys in the room this evening, and capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a third-stage guild navigator, has in fact folded space to become Man Cave, and capably assisted by pinch-hit utility midweek chat room moderator and all-around great guy Steve from Georgia Stan. And a wonderful time will be had by all. I had a note from Ralph saying the White Rose Society Kincaid podcast feed is working. Yay! I hope it stays that way. So we'll see. I mentioned Ben worked on it last night. It was still a little bit glitchy, but maybe he's gotten it all taken care of. That would be wonderful if that is the case. Thank you, Ben Birch. WhiteRoseSociety.org. And thanks to Ralphs for letting me know. If there are any problems, let me know about those too. And that'll probably make Ben cry. But nonetheless. And thank you for jumping in early this evening. Thank you very kindly to Jeremy in Vermont. I said 165. It's 160. Thank you, Jeremy. Thanks a ton. Much appreciated indeed. That's true. Stockton Larry pointing out, come on, Bob, you can never have too many Larrys. No. And, you know, once upon a time, there was even a short-lived program featuring McLean Stevenson called Hello, Larry. Didn't last. That was what he went to after he quit MASH, which was a horrible mistake, but never mind. Where to begin this evening? Well, it is Titanic Tuesday, and on Titanic Tuesdays, of course, we take note, if not celebrate. It's kind of hard to celebrate stupidity, but we take note of manifestations of monumental right-wing intellect. Yeah. And we've got it. And there's, in particular, we talk about civics a lot here. And God knows that new and different kind of Republican, Ben Sasse of Nebraska, talked about it last night, or yesterday, during the opening of the Coney Barrett hearings. But I want to. Dr. Bill had a magnificent program earlier today. I encourage you, if you've never downloaded the Dr. Bill podcast, this would be a great time to start and work your way backwards. It's like master's degree level discussions of civics and American history and how this country came to be the tawdry, screwed-up mess that it is. Right. So, by all means, check it out. But today, in the interest of civics, today I'm going to run some audio, I think, some of the most important audio, I think, that has come out of a congressional hearing in quite some time. And what I'm talking about in this particular instance is the remarks, the civics lesson, basically, given by Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island. Our friends like Elbert and Charlene in Rogues Island have good reason to be proud of the statesman that they have in the form of Sheldon Whitehouse there in their little state. Too many Larrys, says Lee in New York. Impossible. I want to make sure I get this right because it's funny. This is cowbell worthy. Um, Lee says, obligatory Three Stooges reference. Too many Larrys? No, it's all fine. You know, Larry Fine, Three Stooges, right? Yeah. So many Larrys. By chance, if there's a new fraternity, the Fraternity of Larrys, suggested by Dave and the Blind, a proud member of the Fraternity of Daves. In my father's house are many fraternities, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Arnold in PA wants to know, did I catch Lindsey Graham's opening remarks? Lindsey has learned nothing from being alive. Well, Lindsey thought he was being real clever because he came on this morning and he said, listen, I sat here all yesterday and heard everybody talking about the Affordable Care Act. Well, you know who gets all the Affordable Care Act money? Three states. Three states with 20% of the population get 35% of the Affordable Care Act money. That's who gets it. You want to guess who it is? Yes, it's California and New York and Massachusetts. That's who gets all, that's who gets 35% of the Affordable Care Act money. And we in South Carolina, we want some. We want our money.
No, that didn't age well at all, because it didn't take very long for a member of the Democratic caucus in the Senate Judiciary Committee to point out the fact that the reason South Carolina doesn't get as much money is because South Carolina, being a Confederate state, and absolutely terrified what might happen to Republicans there if ordinary workaday people started being able to go to the doctor when they're sick. Well, where does it all end? Because we all know about Precious Lindsey. Well, you know, if they can go to the doctor, they probably just quit going to work. And then where will we be in South Carolina? And he said it utterly oblivious, and again, it was one of those lightning bolt moments that proves my theory, you know. When he said South Carolina wants some of that money, well, Lindsey, Precious, your state gets from the federal government probably $2, $3, $4, $5 for every dollar y'all actually pay in. You're one of those welfare queen taker states, Lindsey. And the big old mean nasty federal government actually tried to give you more money, but y'all said no, because them people would be able to go to the doctor then, and we wouldn't be South Carolina no more. We'd be some commie socialist pinko Kenyan Muslim you slurper paradise, and we ain't gonna let them people go to the doctor when they sick. Arnold pointing out these motherfuckers are practicing law sport. Yeah. Law as blood sport. I'm silently monitoring Coney Barrett, Amy Tony's parrot, having her little coffee clutch with noted Iowa hog deballer Joni Ernst, who hopes that her performance in this hearing will somehow save her her incumbency in the Senate. Me, I can, on the other hand, I can only hope that Iowegians come up with the good sense to bounce her ass out. Really, when your claim to fame is castrating hogs, how does, well, never mind. Just never mind. But Suman just dropped me a note. Suman telling me that breaking news. The United States Supreme Court today stopped the once-a-decade headcount of every U.S. resident from continuing through the end of October. That's right. Old Balls and Strikes Roberts, the man who perjured himself within an inch of his goddamn life in his confirmation hearing. Oh, I'm just going to call balls and strikes. I'm not some sort of ideologue at all. Well, the Trump administration, when they were told by a lower court to go and and keep counting, keep the head count going in the census so we could get an accurate count of the number of people who live in the United States. Well, but then
we'd have to count more of those people.
Who are those?
Whoever they are. You know, not quite as orange as me.
Right. So those wise, wise souls, as the Republicans like to describe them from time to time, those unelected black robe judges have just declared that, well, we don't really need to know how many people live in the United States because most of them, well, most of them don't matter anyway. Necessarily, there was a majority on the court, which means it's with only 8 members of the court. It could have gone 4-4, but it didn't. The Associated Press reporting a coalition of local governments and civil rights groups had sued the Trump administration, arguing that minorities and other hard to count communities would be missed if the count ended early. They said the census schedule was cut short to accommodate a July order from Trump that would exclude people in the country illegally from numbers used to decide how many congressional seats each state gets. Last month, the district judge, Lucy Coe, in San Jose, California, said the plaintiffs were right, and she enjoined the census from stopping the count early. Nonetheless, the census declared that, you know, fuck that, we don't follow what judges say, and said they would end it early nonetheless. The census, of course, is controlled by the Commerce Department. The district judge's order was upheld by the appellate court, so that was 2 wins. And now it went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, nah, don't bother counting those people. They're not really that American anyway. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who for at least the near future is going to spend a lot of time in the wilderness writing dissents. And one of the things about the Supreme Court is that what you find out in dissents is that that's where the actual wisdom of the court resides. Because majority opinions, as often as not, are merely manifestations, especially in the modern era, say, from the Warren Burger Court forward, but primarily from Reagan's Supreme Court appointments forward. Majority opinions in the Supreme Court are, for the most part, merely rubber stamps of right-wing status quo. But nonetheless, Justice Sotomayor said, moreover, meeting the deadline at the expense of the accuracy of the census is not a cost worth paying, especially when the government has failed to show why it could not bear the lesser cost of expending more resources to meet the deadline or continuing its prior efforts to seek an extension from Congress. Because that's one of the things. The Census Bureau complained that, oh, we can't do that, and then didn't bother to offer any evidence that they couldn't do that. Because Donald Trump is a white supremacist. So there's that. And Suman asks, what does this mean? Does this mean the orange orangutan can reallocate House seats? Sorry, I'm not well informed on the workings of the census. It takes a while to sort out all the data from the census, Suman. But it touches everything. From the amounts of money that states get to feed their hungry populations to how many representatives they get. I guess the theory being that if you can undercount California enough, if you can undercount the blue states enough, that you can take some members of the House away from them and maybe, I don't know, give an extra double plus good counting to the fine, upstanding, God-fearing, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, homosexual, Christian, white people, and maybe provide an extra seat here or there in places like Mississippi or Talabama or South Carolina Stan or Georgia Stan or I got a feeling ain't no two ways about it. We're going to lose ourselves a member of the House here in West Virginia, and considering they're all three of them fucking maggots, it doesn't much bother me. That doesn't. No, it doesn't. But an even number court with only eight justices still managed to find a way to fuck the American people and give Donald Trump what he wanted. Give him his racist heart's desire. Yeah. So there's that. Megan says, if Lady G is mad about the Affordable Care Act money, ask us liberals how we feel about the Electoral College, asshole. Oh, don't even get us started. Obamacare money in South Carolina. Steve in New York says, and don't you know that with all that Obamacare money, after everybody quit their jobs, they'd be dining on crab legs for dinner and quail eggs for lunch and watercress sandwiches and shame for shame. Oh, Raul, please get me some smelling salts. I'll be right here under the fainting couch. Yes. Cory Booker is having a little talk with Coney Barrett. Let's check in on that real quick.
Well, Senator, that seems to me to be pulling me in a little bit into this question of whether the president has said that he would not peacefully leave office. And so to the extent that this is a political controversy right now, as a judge, I want to stay out of it, and I don't want to express a view on...
So, Judge, I appreciate what you've said about respecting our founding fathers, about the originalism. It's remarkable that we're in a place right now that this is becoming a question and a topic, but I'm asking you, in light of our founding fathers,
we're going to talk about originalism.
In light that everyone who serves in that office has sworn an oath where they, quote, swear to preserve and protect and defend the Constitution of the United States, I'm just asking you, should a president commit themselves? Like, our founding fathers, I think, have a clear intention. Like, the grace that George Washington showed to the peaceful transfer of power, is that something that presidents should be able to do?
Well, one of the beauties of America from the beginning of the Republic is that we have had peaceful transfers of power, and that disappointed voters have accepted the new leaders that come into office. And that's not true in every country. And I think it is part of the genius of our Constitution and the good faith and goodwill of the American people that we haven't had the situations that have arisen in so many other countries where there have been, where those issues have been present.
Thank you, Your Honor. Do you think that the president has the power to pardon himself for any past or future crimes he may have committed against the United States of America?
Well, Senator Booker, that would be a legal question. That would be a constitutional question. And so in keeping with my obligation not to give hints, previews, or forecasts of how I would resolve the case, that's not one that I can answer.
Well, I think I agree with you that it is an issue right now, something I never thought would be an issue before. But it is an issue that our president may intend to pardon himself for future crimes or past crimes. If a president is personally responsible for several hundred million dollars in debt while he's in office, potentially to foreign entities, do you think he has a responsibility to disclose who his lenders are, especially given the Emoluments Clause?
Well, Senator, there's litigation about the Emoluments Clause. I think it was in the Fourth Circuit. I don't know where it stands, but that clearly is an issue that's being litigated and one present in courts is not one on which I can offer an opinion.
Thank you. I think it's disturbing that we're having this conversation. I think it's disturbing that we have a president that has brought what should be settled in the minds of most Americans. Presidents should reveal what their debts are, especially if they're to foreign nations. Presidents should not be able to pardon themselves for future crimes. Presidents should condemn white supremacy. Presidents should commit themselves to the peaceful transfer of power. Judge Barrett, you've seen a lot of my colleagues and I put up pictures of people in this room and the stories we've told, and I've appreciated the way you've listened. It's not a stretch to understand why a lot of Americans are afraid right now. All we have to do is look at the statements and actions of my Republican colleagues, the Republican Party platform.
And let's be clear, not Americans just afraid. And I wish they would speak a little bit more plainly to her. It's obvious that they're scared. Judge Handmaid, do you understand why millions of Americans are scared to death of you, lady? You and what you plan on doing to them with your wild-eyed, God-forsaken, radical right-wing pissant interpretation of the Constitution? Ma'am, do you understand that people are afraid that you are going to fucking kill them? Do you understand that, ma'am?
Because House and Senate Republicans have tried to do it 70 times. The one Republican who did not was an attorney general who joined 20 state attorney generals who sued to overturn the Affordable Care Act. You yourself said, and now I will quote you, that Chief Justice Roberts pushed the Affordable Care Act beyond its plausible meaning to save the statute. The same Chief Justice Roberts that Trump implied didn't do the right thing. And so, Judge Barrett, you have said that if you were on the court, you will hear and consider the arguments from both sides. I was actually very interested when you said that you would put your family members in the shoes of litigants on both sides. Given all that you've heard said over and over again about the intentions to tear away the Affordable Care Act, to end the Affordable Care Act, given what you've heard about the people who rely on it, given the commitment, you know, that President Trump's to said explicitly to only appoint judges who would overturn the ACA, is it unreasonable for people to fear, putting yourself in the shoes of people, is it unreasonable for the people that have been up here as in their pictures, is it unreasonable for them to fear that the ACA would be overturned if you were confirmed to the court?
Well, Senator, I want to stress to you, Senator Booker, as I've stressed to some of your colleagues today, that I am my own person. I'm independent under Article 3.
Sure you are, of Donald.
You know, I don't take orders from the executive branch or the legislative branch.
I understand that. I guess, can I restate my question? Because I don't think you are understanding it.
Sure.
I'm just asking you as an act of empathy, can you understand the fears that are exhibited by the people we put up? The two people I put up, Michelle and Merritt, I don't know what their political party is. I don't know if they're going to vote for me. I'm on the ballot. I don't know. I just know that they were people that wanted their voices to be heard because they are afraid right now and what your nomination represents. All I'm asking is, can you empathize with that? Can you understand that?
Senator, I can certainly empathize with people who are struggling. I can empathize with people who lack health care. You know, one of the things that was so striking to me...
Senator, I don't give a goddamn about them. They've never contributed a goddamn dime to the Republican Party. They haven't contributed a goddamn dime to a pro-life organization. Senator, I don't give a fuck about your constituents.
You know, should I be confirmed? And as I've said, I would consider the issue of recusal a threshold question of law and whether to hear that case. But should I be confirmed and should I sit and hear the case? As I assured you, I would consider all the arguments on both sides. And one of the important issues in that case is whether, even if the mandate has become unconstitutional since it was zeroed out, whether it would be consistent with the will of Congress for the whole act to fall, it's a statutory question, not a constitutional one, or whether the mandate could be severed out and the rest of the act stand. And so the task of every justice who hears this case will be to look at the structure of the statute and look at its text to determine whether it was the will of Congress when they passed the ACA.
And Judge, I apologize, especially after the good behavior that was noted, that we shouldn't be talking over each other.
No, that's okay, Senator.
My time is running quickly.
Sure.
I guess I just, as a guy who looks at justices, I was just asking you to express that you understand the fear that's in America right now, because you've heard story after story of people who don't know if they're going to be able to afford their health care.
And you can't say that
they will be denied insurance coverage. And I'm going to move on because of the short time. But I was just asking you, can you understand the fear, given a president that has said that they will put justice on there, that will tear down the Affordable Care Act, thus taking away health care for millions of Americans? There is fear in our country right now. But I want to move now to earlier what Senator Durbin and you discussed. They asked about your views on racism and the role of courts in addressing racial justice. I was troubled that you said that racial justice and equality, and I'll quote you, or how to tackle the issue of making it better, those things are policy questions. I think that that's the quote. How to tackle the issue of making it better, the racial injustice, those things are policy questions and not for the court. The federal government's own data, and this is, I think you and I referenced this in our private conversation, which I appreciate. You said you were familiar with a lot of the data about the discrimination within our criminal justice system. For example, the U.S. Sentencing Commission shows that prosecutors are more, this is the U.S. Sentencing Commission said the prosecutors are more likely to charge black defendants with offenses that carry harsh mandatory minimum sentences than similarly situated whites. Are you familiar with that, the U.S. Sentencing Commission?
I'm not familiar with that particular
sentence. Does that surprise you?
I don't know, Senator Booker, that seems an odd thing for me to express an opinion out.
Senator, it's not really a matter of whether I'm surprised or not. It's whether I give a fuck, and I don't.
Study, as you and I discussed, I am aware that there is evidence and that there have been studies of systemic racism or implicit bias in the justice system. So I am aware of that issue. I was not aware.
You're aware of evidence that there is implicit racial bias.
I am aware that there have been studies showing that implicit bias is present in many contexts, including in the criminal justice system.
Okay. I'm just going to read some of these other statistics because I think they're really important. And this is independent data from the U.S. Sentencing Commission. And black defendants, again, are compared with similarly situated white defendants who are subject to three-strike sentencing enhancements at a significant higher rate, which on average added 10 years to sentences. You're not familiar with that study.
I'm not familiar with that study.
I don't give a shit about that study.
The three-strikes cases?
Yes.
Are you talking about the three strikes, the Prison Litigation Reform Act cases where they're struck out? Or are you talking about?
I'm asking cases in the criminal justice system that relate to racial bias. Do they come before the court?
So certainly we have discrimination cases. Certainly there are 1983 cases or Title VII cases.
I would imagine so. And in those, in your research for those cases, you familiarize yourself with a lot of the data on the discrimination within the system.
That, you know, we familiarize ourselves with the arguments the parties make and the information that they put in the record. And in some cases, I have had parties submit, or it's submitted in the district court technically and then made part of the record.
And so I just want to be clear. Do you believe that there is, in fact, implicit racial bias in the criminal justice system?
Well,
which is just a yes or no question. Do you believe, in fact, that there is implicit racial bias in the criminal justice
system? Needs to be asked as a leading question.
It's hard to imagine a system, a criminal justice system as big as ours, not having any implicit bias in it.
So is that a yes?
Senator, yes, I think that in our large criminal justice system, it would be inconceivable that there wasn't some implicit bias.
Wait, implicit racial bias is a function of the size of the system? Are you fucking kidding me?
The federal court.
If it was just a smaller system, there would be less racial bias
within the justice system, quite clearly. I'd like to turn to an opinion you wrote last year about race discrimination, Smith versus Illinois Department of Transportation. The case involved an African-American traffic patrol officer who had been fired from the Illinois Department of Transportation. This employee claimed that he had been subjected to hostile work environment and that the supervisor called him the N-word. But you ruled that the employee had failed to make the case that he had been fired in retaliation for his complaints about race discrimination. And now you acknowledged that, quote, and I'm going to quote you now, the N-word is an egregious racial epithet. But you went on to insist that the employee couldn't, quote, win simply by proving that the N-word was uttered at them. And that he failed to show that his supervisor's use of the N-word
was just
against
uttered.
Him, quote, altered the conditions of his employment and created a hostile or abusive working environment. And you said that even based on his own subjective experience, this black employee had, quote, no evidence that his supervisors were lashing out at him because he was black. I'm very surprised to have to make this point at all, but even a staunch conservative like Justice Kavanaugh, in my questioning of him, spoke to the obvious harm here in a way that you don't seem to. He wrote in a court of appeals case that, quote, being called the N-word by a supervisor suffices by itself to establish a racially hostile work environment. And you disagreed with that. Why do you believe that the law recognizes the harm that is inflicted on a black person in this country when they are called that word by their work supervisor, or by anyone really for that matter, and all the history dredged up in that word, centuries of harm? Why do you believe differently than Justice Kavanaugh?
Well, Senator Booker, that opinion does not take a position different than Justice Kavanaugh. It expressly and was written very carefully to leave open the possibility that one use of that word would be sufficient to make out a hostile work environment claim. The problem was that in that case, the evidence that the plaintiff had relied on to establish the hostile work environment involved other, you know, he was driving the wrong way down a ramp, and then expletives were used, not the N-word. And the N-word was used after his termination had already begun. And he didn't argue under clear Supreme Court precedent. I didn't make up the objective-subjective element. Under clear Supreme Court precedent, both are required. And he didn't say that it altered the terms of, that's not how he pled or made his case. And it was a unanimous panel decision.
And forgive me if I'm reading this case wrong, but you're saying to me he was not claiming that he had a hostile work environment and that it is in the fact pattern that this supervisor called him the N-word, and that does not constitute a hostile work environment in the way that Justice Kavanaugh said clearly that it does?
No, Senator, I think you're mischaracterizing what I said with all respect. In that opinion, the evidence that he introduced to show the hostile work environment was the use of expletives when he drove the wrong way down. He was hired to be a safety driver for the Illinois Department of Transportation, and he based his hostile work environment claim on the use of expletives at him based on poor work performance. That was what he relied upon, and then his termination proceedings had begun. He didn't tie the use of the N-word into the evidence that he introduced for his hostile work environment claim. And so as a panel, we were constrained to decide based on the case the plaintiff had presented before us. So the panel very carefully...
We really wanted to rule for him, but he didn't say that calling him the N-word created the hostile work environment.
I'm going to turn to the AutoZone case you discussed earlier with Senator Feinstein. The initial panel of three judges that examined the case ruled against Kevin Stuckey. You were not a part of that initial panel, but you did have an opportunity to vote on whether to hear the case before the entire court. You had an opportunity to affirm the bedrock principle enshrined in Brown versus Board of Education about separate but equal, really to say that separate is inherently unequal. But you voted no. You didn't think the full court needed to examine this deliberate segregation of employees by race. But the judges on the court disagreed with you. In fact, three judges explained, we know that, quote, deliberate racial segregation by its very nature has an adverse effect on the people subjected to it. On one of the essential teachings of Brown versus Board of Education, which I know you're familiar with, is that idea of separate being inherently unequal. Why did you think that these separate but equal facilities were lawful, or why didn't you see this as a practice that was worthy of closer scrutiny?
Senator, as I said earlier to Senator Feinstein, I did not make a merits decision on that case, and I wasn't on the initial panel. The calculation of whether to take a case en banc is different than a merits determination. So I wasn't reaching any decision about whether Title VII applied to that situation or not. Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure, I think it's 35, that governs en banc proceedings, sets out standards, and this case didn't create an intra-circuit conflict or an inter-circuit conflict. And so I didn't think it met Federal Rule of... All my vote means is that I didn't feel like it satisfied the elevated high standard for en banc review, not that I thought it was correct.
God, what a circus. I want to I mean, I've been furious all day. Because it's one thing to be lied to. It's another to be lied to with a side of piety. It's kind of like something Ralph's just said by email. With all respect, really? Like the Godfather?
With all respect, Godfather, on this, the day of your child's marriage.
Yeah. Anyone, Megan asks, anyone finding it a bit ironic that people are afraid of possibly being killed by the pro-life candidate? Hell, Megan, that's not irony. That's just plain old predictability. And Ron, and maybe this is the time to get into it. Ron in Raleigh with a note. Really? Originalism? Let me get this straight. A woman born in the 20th century, being confirmed for a seat on the Supreme Court in the 21st century, thinks she can get inside the heads of 18th century men and divine their intent. Holy shit, that's a hell of a trick. She says she's a devotee of Fat Dead Tony. I always found that Fat Dead Tony contorted the law to fit his personal beliefs. I'm not trained in the law, but it seemed obvious to me. Well, sometimes you don't need to be, Ron, because you got it right. And I want to take a moment with this this business of originalism. Understand that originalism is not an old concept. In the law, in the law and in the history of the law tends to look toward ancient definitions to try to figure out what something has meant through time. Because the law is essentially a linguistic exercise. Linguistic with some philosophy scattered in here and there. And most law goes back to religion, frankly. It's only with the rise of the Enlightenment. And before that, and we've talked about this some. Particularly the King of England reaching out and saying, what's the point in being king if I can't say what the law is? I'm not really the king. I'm some sort of placeholder for the church. And the English kings were right in that regard. A lot of it goes back to Henry II, who finally brought institutional stability to England and set up the administrative state that we know to this day. And so through the Chancellor, wherein develops the idea of equity, which would answer questions that the king's law couldn't. Well, that's how the idea of the English common law develops. And so consequently, you have to look at meanings. So before I completely lose my train of thought, what I'm getting at here is, for instance, Blackstone, okay? And I'm not talking about the vaudeville magician or anything. Blackstone was an English jurist. And they were written in the 17th century by Sir William Blackstone. And they were published between 1765 and 1770. in legal terms, that's kind of a Johnny come lately. Blackstone had been a justice of the Court of King's Bench. He was a 17th century Tory. That means he was a conservative. But he tried to set down, he set about to try to set down what the English common law meant and how to define it. After that, you get Cook's jurisprudence, and he's more interested in the hierarchy of judges and the relationship between the monarch and the parliament. And so he's another one of those people that we look to if we want to find old meanings in the law. He actually predates William Blackstone, having been a barrister, that means a trial lawyer, a judge, and a politician. And he was the person looked to in the Elizabethan and Jacobean eras for what the law meant. Among other things, he went after the Court of Star Chamber, which remains to this day a phrase that makes people spit on the ground, where people would be tried in absentia and sentenced by a group of secret judges that met in the Star Chamber. Okay, I think we're making some progress here. As is always the case, it seems, when we have a Supreme Court confirmation hearing, there will be a discussion of stare decisis. It's a Latin phrase. It means that things that have been decided are going to stay decided, and we're not just going to overturn things for the hell of it because we want to have some level of consistency within the law. Think of it, precedent. And today we're talking about super precedents. She says that Brown versus Board of Education is a super precedent, but Roe v. Wade, of course, is not. Well, stare decisis is an idea that's been around for a while. It is an old idea. Within American jurisprudence, another old idea is the notion that the Supreme Court, and we were talking about Marbury versus Madison, the idea that the Supreme Court will be the final word on what the Constitution means. And that goes back to Chief Justice John Marshall. And I mention all of this primarily for the purpose of explaining that originalism is not an ancient concept of the law. Originalism is, for the most part, a thing that was ginned up by right-wing judges in the latter part of the 20th century as they sought to push back against political and cultural and social liberalization of our country. they saw things like the Miranda decision that said you have to inform someone being arrested of their rights. And they said, liberalism! An entire industry rose up around the backlash against the Supreme Court case that says it's not okay to force, for a school district to force its religious beliefs on the children who go to public schools. And this was something that had been a while in coming, because in the 1940s, the Supreme Court didn't have any problem reaching a decision that you can't, for instance, force little Jehovah's Witness kids to say the Pledge of Allegiance. That case actually came up out of West Virginia. And we look at it now, it makes sense. Unless, of course, you're a religious maniac like Amy Tony's parrot. Who proudly calls herself an originalist. But the right-wing reactionaries saw things like that and said, Jesus! Because after the court said that you can't force a kid to say the Pledge of Allegiance, and it's not okay just to send them out into the hallway so that they can be further stigmatized. Well, okay. Along comes a woman named Madeline Murray O'Hare. And she sued over prayer in schools. And like I said, that engendered an entire religious industry whose rallying war cry was, they've done tooken Jesus and God out of our skews. And God, it runs out like ripples in a pond unto this very day. The Chief Justice of the Alabama State Supreme Court, Roy Tola Moore, had to be slapped down by the federal courts, and I don't know if this woman would do it, because after all, remember, her job as a lawyer, she has said, is to build the kingdom of God, inshallah. I don't know if the Supreme Court would take the same approach to as was taken to Roy Tola Moore when he wanted to put his Ten Commandments rocks all over the place and hang the Ten Commandments in schools because it's the foundation of our Judeo-Christian law. Nah, you fucking dumbass. People like Blackstone and Cook. People like David Hume. Hobbes are the foundation of our Enlightenment judicial system, or were. Yeah. But that was one of those moments that empowered and energized the right wing in this country, and they have raised billions, if not trillions, of dollars off of crying out that we ain't allowed to have no prayer in school. When in fact, the Supreme Court never, ever, 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 even once has said that prayer in school is illegal or unconstitutional. What the Supreme Court said was unconstitutional, because it was a violation of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, that Congress shall establish no religion, was having a set prayer that everybody had to pray. And frankly, I'm old enough that I can remember growing up and going to public schools in Alabama, which, having had desegregation forced upon them, decided that, well, by God, we're still going to pray. And so instead of praying, and this was every day of my high school career. Started in 1977, ended in 1981. Every day, somebody went to the principal's office and read from the Bible and then led the Pledge of Allegiance. Some of us who were more creative did things like finding Bible verses that talked about stoning people to death or Lot's daughters lying with their daddy and thinking he was good. And Lot was a righteous man. Or the kid who came and read from the Quran. And it kind of put our fundy principal in a box. Because he really couldn't do anything about it. Little moments of resistance. And their tongue shall rot in their mouths, and their eyeballs shall burn out of their heads. Right. Uplifting devotional for the day. But the right wing, if they are anything, and they are prodigious liars. And so they told this lie that those liberals on the court have taken Jesus and God out of the schoolhouse. Right? And it worked really well. My God, it was fantastic. The money just rolled in. And they filed lawsuits, and it continues to be a thorn of contention, bone of contention. But they learned something from that. They learned that they could fleece the Marks, I mean the Rubes, I mean their constituencies, and live really good lives pursuing things that were patently untrue. And then along comes Roe v. Wade. A simple and yet not simple question of whether states have the right to limit a woman's access to make a decision about whether to carry a pregnancy to term. And it was predicated on the holdings out of Griswold versus Connecticut that said that married couples have a right to privacy to use contraception so that, you know, they're not just so that every American family doesn't have, you know, 15 kids and women's reproductive organs aren't treated like a clown car. And Roe is a long read. And it represented a good faith effort to answer a tough question. Or what was deemed to be a tough question. If a woman has a right to an abortion, what is the extent of that right? And so once again, just like they lie, just like these right-wing judges lie, and these right-wing apparatchiks and various and sundry misanthropes and monstrosities, just like they lied about prayer in school, so they lie about reproductive care. And we've already heard yesterday in this hearing about the precious little babies that the Democrats, the Demoncrats, want to get born and let the demon doctors sit there and chop them up into chutney on the way out of the birth canal. They cut them all to pieces. I think Precious Lindsay was one of the ones grunting and hooting about that. Reckon Lindsay's ever had to worry about an unplanned pregnancy? Because I'm guessing the answer's no. And so that climate, wherein there was a realization that a shit ton of money was to be made out of lying to the American people about the status of constitutional law was part of the overarching atmosphere at a time when a guy named Lewis Powell wrote something called the Powell Memo, 1972, in which he laid out a roadmap by which the right wing in this country and their corporate allies could fund organizations that would then in turn pollute our body politic and drag this country back into the dark ages. And later on, Lewis Powell, having authored this roadmap, the Powell Memo, would be rewarded with a seat on the Supreme Court of the United States by, I believe, Gerald Ford. And along comes Reagan with his Russian bear ads and his Morning in America ads and his shining city on a hill bullshit. And then you get to the appointment of Robert Bork. And Robert Bork is a sea change moment in American judicial history, because Robert Bork was sent to the court by Reagan expressly as a fuck you to every woman who believed she had a right to control the workings of her own body, and a finger in the eye to every male ally who shared that belief. And Bork was rejected because Bork was a maniac. And so with the rejection of Bork, we get... And they turned it into a verb, to be borked. It's curious how a Senate rejecting an unqualified Supreme Court nominee who was unqualified because of his wild-eyed ideology... That becomes a verb, to be borked. And yet, to be garlanded still is not in the in our linguistic currency, which is to be eminently qualified for one's job, but to be kept out of that job solely for tawdry partisan political purposes. There were legitimate questions about Robert Bork's qualifications that went all the way back to the bad old days of Richard Nixon, when various practitioners of the law refused to participate in Richard Nixon's filthy schemes. But Robert Bork said, "Oh, I'm your boy." Robert Bork was dangerous. And it's been all downhill since then, but along the way, a term finds its way into scholarly discussions of American constitutional law. A term made up entirely from whole cloth. No history to it, no precedent, no intimations of it. And they birthed this noxious baby, and they called it originalism. And in a way, there's something about originalism that reminds me of... it reminds me of Ayn Rand, because we were talking about her a few nights back. She came up with a bullshit philosophy of selfishness and greed and avarice and tacked a fancy-sounding name on it, and suddenly it was a philosophy, when all it is just a bullshit pop psychology for people who want to say, "I got mine, fuck you." And that was objectivism. Again, another bullshit theory. And originalism is something similar. And once he ascended to the court, fat now dead Tony Scalia became the high priest of originalism. And originalism said, we are going to interpret the Constitution only in the way that the original framers of the Constitution, the people who ratified it, understood their words to mean and be. And what you'll find is, if you scratch the surface of originalism, originalism is nothing but an implausible horseshit argument for plain old Machiavellian ends justify the means based jurisprudence. Here's what we want to do. Here's what we're going to say in order for us to do what we want to do. And we're going to say that we're following the intent of the framers. DC versus Heller, the Second Amendment case, claims to be originalist in nature. Fat dead Tony Scalia wrote that opinion, claiming to channel the inner workings of the minds of Madison and Hamilton and Jay, of George Washington, the president of the Constitutional Convention, of Benjamin Franklin, the sage who informed the debates. Might as well use a crystal ball or a tattered purple robe with a frayed applique moons and stars and "Will Thee Kiss Me in the Dark, Baby" written across the front, and a magic eight ball that's got a cracked screen that always says, "Answer hazy, ask me again later." Because it's nothing more than smoke and mirrors. You want to take apart originalism? I kind of misspoke a minute ago when I said that originalism had no precedent. But it does. Originalism has lots of precedent. Every terrible, awful, noxious, bad piece of jurisprudence that ever emanated from the Supreme Court prior to 1920 or so, no, let's say 1930, is originalist in nature. You want the ultimate, and of course nobody's going to bring this up because we're just, well, you know, we're too refined there in the Senate. We're not going to say anything to make anybody upset. And nobody's going to challenge originalism because it's become, it's old enough now that it's And what's that line? I know what I'm thinking about. Give me just a minute because it's going to fit perfectly. Yeah, there it is. This is exactly where originalism is now.
Politicians, ugly buildings, and whores all get respectable if they last long enough.
And so do noxious judicial philosophies. Originalism has a little bit of age on it now, so there are enough grasping right wingers who've gone to law school and declared themselves to be devotees of it. That you've got a small, that there's a small army of, well, no, it's not small, and it's well-funded, far better funded than our side. And so originalism is a thing, even though it's just the worst of American jurisprudence with a little bit of spit polish on it. Because you want to know the ultimate originalist decision in this country? The ultimate originalist Supreme Court decision you know, don't you? Dred Scott. At the time that those revered framers, remember, who people like Amy Tony's parrot and Fat Dead Tony himself said that they could divine the workings of their mind. Well, at the time that they were ratifying the Constitution, they came up with a compromise notion that an individual with dark skin was only 3/5 of a human being for census purposes, so that the South could maintain a death grip, a Southern minority could maintain a death grip on a Northern majority in Congress, both in the Senate and with the 3/5 clause in the House. Because going back to 1787, shit, Georgia didn't have near the population that Pennsylvania had. South Carolina didn't have near the population that New York had. Virginia didn't have near the population that Massachusetts or New Jersey had. And so the racist framers of the Constitution decided that it would just be way too much to count a slave as a full human being, because that could open a real can of worms. And so they landed on 3/5 for their ciphering purposes. And so by the time that a man named Dred Scott, who had been a hostler in a hotel in Florence, Alabama, where the Lauderdale County Department of Health now stands. Well, the man who claimed ownership of him moved on to St. Louis. And eventually Dred Scott got into, I think, Illinois, and filed suit for his freedom. And the case went all the way to the Supreme Court, where Chief Justice Roger Taney, who was a hell of a lot closer in time to the framers of the Constitution than Amy or Fat Dead Tony ever can be or will be. Well, he said, "We have never had a moment in which a person with black skin was considered to be a fully free human being. And once a slave, everybody agrees, always a slave. And it's always been that way. And there's always been a lottery. And lottery in June, corn heavy soon." That's a literary reference. It didn't say that. It's always been slavery. Framers knew there was slavery. Framers approved of slavery. They could have eliminated slavery if they wanted to, but they didn't. So no, Dred Scott, you're not free. You're going to be a slave till your black ass dies. Because that's what the framers' original intent was. And you can do the same thing with Plessy versus Ferguson. And you can do the same thing with the slaughterhouse cases. Hell, you can do the same thing with Lochner. Lochner. Oh, hold on a damn minute. State of New York coming in here saying they're going to say what the rules are and aren't for whether a man can work as a baker. Why, in the time of the founding of this republic, there weren't any unions. There wasn't any state government to say that they were looking out for the health and well-being of a baker. That's not constitutional! And then they started inventing bullshit lies like, why, every baker there enjoys privity of contract with his employer. And it is a sacred relationship, like unto marriage. And no state has the right to interfere with the contractual relationship between a man and his employer. Theirs is an equal status, and it would be an offense to the founding of this nation and the ratification of this Constitution if we were to allow the state to establish health and safety rules for working people. The nerve! And that's all originalism is a stealth attempt to go back to Lochner, to Plessy, and yeah, even to Dred Scott. Hell, an originalist might even say that we need to overturn Marbury versus Madison, but those nine wise souls wouldn't do that because, well, then they'd just be a debating society sitting around spending their lifetime appointments having beer and Skittles. But make no mistake, originalism is an intellectual fraud. And you know it by virtue of the fact that their originalism never reaches the things that the framers originally believed. Very few of the people who ratified the Constitution would sit calmly by and say, well, how about that? I guess that's where we were headed all along, wasn't it? To see a woman in a confirmation hearing before the Senate of the United States to have a seat on the Supreme Court. That is not to say there were no people who could foresee that. Oh, no. John Adams's wife, who was probably about 10 times as intelligent as John, wrote him a letter saying, when you're making this Constitution, don't forget the ladies. Because she was managing a stock portfolio, and John Adams would have died as broke as Thomas Jefferson if it weren't for her. She could see a time in the future when women would take their just and righteous and rightful place in the American governmental experiment and experience. She could see it. Other women could see it, too. You come up into the you come up into the 19th century and you get a woman like Anne Royal, who felt so strongly that she was the equal of any man, that she wound up getting herself tried as a common scold in the courts of Washington, D.C., and convicted as a common scold because she made life miserable for politicians, because she called out their hypocrisy. But if we're going to use originalism, let's be honest about it. Because not a single woman who has sat on this court would be sitting there if the framers of the Constitution had their way. The original intent of the Constitution was that only white male real property owners, slave owners, too. Well, property owners of a certain value, didn't have to just be real property. But only white male property owners should exercise the vote. And nobody should ever vote for a senator. And their original vision of the presidency and the vice presidency was one in which the winner was the president and the guy who came in second was the vice president. That didn't work very well at all. They fixed that right quick. And then there's the Second Amendment. If you want to be honest about originalism, the original intent of the framers of the Constitution was that no individual would own anything more than a musket. Damn sure not something that'll fling out 100 rounds in under a minute. Oh, no. Originalism is a garbage philosophy that, unfortunately, we give too much attention to. And the only reason I'm spending the amount of time that I'm spending talking about it is because I'm sick to death of seeing it treated like some sort of fucking sacred cow when it's just a cheap-ass right-wing, petty-fogging, faux jurisprudential parlor trick. It's originalism anytime they get what they want, but anytime you throw the actual original intent up at them, they go, well, that's not originalism. I mean, we're not saying women shouldn't vote or anything. But that was the original intent, boys and girls. Handmaid of Donald, you shouldn't be sitting there. And that's why Ruth Bader Ginsburg was no goddamned originalist. And Sonia Sotomayor is no goddamned originalist. And Elena Kagan is no originalist. Because they understand that originalism is a place that the United States of America never wants to go to again. My God, the relative life expectancy of women versus men in the age and era of the originals, the framers, what founders, what God Almighty. You can find histories of men who have four and five wives, and it's not because they were philanderers. It's because their wives kept dying in childbirth or dying of things subsequent to childbirth. Abraham Lincoln's mother died of something called milk sickness. That was a poison that people picked up on the frontier. There were the babies who didn't live past 1 or 2 years old. And when your wife died, you went and found another one because you got to have somebody to help you along the way. And in that grand day of the libertarian experiment, there was one thing in this world you did not wish to be. And that was a childless woman who had been widowed. Because libertarian America, you know, back when we had all that freedom, would simply let her die. We did the same thing with the aged, too. Remember, originalism despises Social Security. Originalism despises workers' compensation. Originalism despises any evolution of our legal and social contract. And so Mike in Cascadia says, originalism equals regressionism. Right wing have been masters of the language and particularly euphemisms for their favored positions. Exactly. They are absolutely devils when it comes to it. Regressivism. We call ourselves progressives. The other side are regressives. Originalism, says Steve in New York, here's what you do. One, confirm that she thinks she should read the Constitution for what the words meant at the time the founders wrote the words. Two, take the Second Amendment. Three, does that mean an originalist should interpret the meaning of the term arms in terms of what it meant in 1789?
Four, were semi-automatic weapons around in 1789? Automatic weapons, multi-round handguns? No, 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 no. Ergo.
Well, no, that's not what we mean. I mean, technology advances, but we're talking about
And see, they couldn't even be honest about the father of originalism, Fat Dead Tony, couldn't even be honest about it. Because when he got a chance to interpret the Second Amendment, he blew right past that whole, the entire beginning of the amendment. And said that it was just a verbal flourish. You know what I'm talking about. The Second Amendment says that a well-regulated militia being necessary to a free state, I'm paraphrasing here, the right to keep and bear arms. Okay, here it is. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That's the whole Second Amendment. But Fat Dead Tony Scalia said the part about a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of the free state, the entire condition precedent to the next clause, he said that was just a verbal flourish. That was just the framers showing off. So that was originalism, too, because he professed to be inside the minds of the framers, that they really weren't talking about a well-regulated militia. That the only thing they wanted to make sure of was that, you know, everybody could have a fucking howitzer as soon as they were goddamned invented. Or that right-wing fat asses in Michigan could have a bazooka as soon as they were invented. You'll recall that Fat Dead Tony Scalia once quipped, because he was a smartass too, and I don't care if Ruth Bader Ginsburg liked him. You know, I'm one of those people that favors that bumper sticker language that says mean people suck, and he was mean people. Fat Dead Tony once said that he wasn't sure, but that if you could carry it, a citizen of the new United States of America probably could have a bazooka. And so I just want us to understand, when this word gets bandied about and she talks about it as though it's some sort of wisdom that she received through the machinations of a goddamn burning bush at the foot of Sinai, I want you to understand, she's a liar. She is a prevaricator. She is adhering to a philosophy that is not a philosophy. It's a poppycock gumball idea come up with by people who wanted to be taken seriously as legal scholars, but couldn't find anything else to get legal and scholarly about. Because to come all the way back to the beginning of what I was saying, the reason you get any of this to begin with is because you've got a bunch of old white men who are scared of where the culture is going. They are terrified by the expansion of rights, when in fact a country that aspires toward democracy must always aspire toward the expansion of rights. More rights are always better for a free society than less rights. This is not a complicated concept. Remember, under the original intent of the framers, the dear friends and members of this community who were finally able to get married to the person that they loved as a result of the Obergefell decision, originalism says
there can't be an Obergefell decision. Remember that Fat Dead Tony infamously noted that the Constitution does not give you a right not to be executed unjustly by the state. Fat Dead Tony Scalia went to his grave convinced that there is nothing in the Constitution that says it's wrong for you to be executed for a crime you did not commit. Which is really not surprising for the son of the guy who was the head of the Mussolini fan club in the United States in the 1930s. Originalism. Originalism says that Loving versus Virginia, that established the right of people of different skin colors to get married. Originalism says that can't exist. Originalism says that the decision that said you can't execute what was then referred to as mentally retarded children can't exist. Every decent thing that has happened in American jurisprudence, and God knows they're rare as fucking hen's teeth, would be forbidden under Fat Dead Tony's originalism. Originalism is nothing but prettied up fascism. Because remember, fascism always relies on tradition and what the ancients thought. A lot of the ruins that are actually uncovered and visible now in Rome were still buried when Mussolini came to power. But he needed to reestablish the imagery of the Roman Empire. And so he used state funds as a fascist to excavate Roman ruins. Because heritage, not hate. It's just, originalism's just dressed up fascism. And it's intellectually lazy and dishonest. Flavio with a note, originalism is an intellectual fraud. Thank you for that. That was really in depth. Sheldon Whitehouse was magisterial today. I hope yet to get to that that audio. And last night at the only debate between them, between Amy McGrath and Moscow Mitch. Yeah, this really did happen. Moscow Mitch chuckled about 200,000 dead Americans. Really? Yeah. Here it is.
The House passed a bill in May, and this Senate went on vacation. I mean, you just don't do that. You negotiate. Senator, it is a national crisis. Yeah. You knew that the coronavirus wasn't going to end at the end of July. We knew this. I mean, I just think...
And Chinless Mitch sits there with his mouth open in that rictus grin, like he's sucking air in like a sea turtle that just came out of the water.
You've got to... And here's the thing, if you want to call yourself a leader,
so Bill,
if you want to call yourself a leader, you got to get things done. And those of us that served in the Marines, we don't just point fingers at the other side. We get the job.
Remember, he torpedoed, Moscow Mitch did, he torpedoed having a female moderator. I guess he's one of those originalists isn't he? And you heard it. One individual referring to him as Confederate Voldemort. Laughing at 1,700 dead doctors and nurses. Laughing at thousands of dead teachers. Laughing at nursing homes full of dead, of our dead elders who aren't as wealthy as him and didn't marry Elaine Chao's family's money and can't use the rules of the Senate to make sure that he can't get sick. Yeah. And there's a better than even chance that the people of the Commonwealth of Kentucky will return this monster to office. Now, Bill, I want to talk about that aluminum smelter over there that my Russian friends are building. Yeah. Note from Cynthia in the Bay Area. Bazooka hell! Why can't I have my own atomic bomb? I mean, certainly the Second Amendment in Amy Toney's Parrot's originalist eyes allows people, even insane ones, to own all manner of guns and assault rifles, so why can't I have a howitzer? Especially, you know, one that shoots atomic shells. Why I ought to be able to shoot one of those off anywhere I want. And I ought to have open carry with it, too. Second Amendment rights, you know. Freedom! Wolverines! Yeah. Kenneth from Portland. Legitimate question, Bob, and I know you've discussed this before in some detail. Let's say, for the sake of argument, Trump loses and then does aggressively dispute the election results for any number of reasons. Could you see a situation where he could, in a worst-case scenario, declare martial law and enact a nationwide lockdown with support of the military, his fascist right-wing terrorist street thugs and police around the country? It does sound far-fetched and science fiction-y, but I put nothing past this piece of shit. Do you think that declaring himself dear leader for life and turning this country into an authoritarian dictatorship within the realm of possibility? It's something I think about and worry about a lot. I put nothing past him. If we're not terrified of a scenario like that, we're just not paying attention, thanks as always. Well, look. He's already declared, what, 1, 2 states of emergency? And the President of the United States, not just COVID Caligula there, has some pretty awesome and, in fact, terrifying emergency powers. Oh, yeah. So it is not beyond the realm of possibility. But I think there are a lot of things that have to happen beforehand. He might need, for instance, as the folks at the Project for a New American Century were talking about in at the end of the 1990s, he might need some sort of a modern-day Pearl Harbor. But it is within, it's within the realm of possibility. But it is it's an extremely complicated process, and I don't know if he has the brains to do it, frankly. Lee in New York says, Tony's originalism, so originalism was his religion. I get it. Oh, no. The Roman Catholicism that involves wrapping barbed wire around your thigh and wearing hair shirts and whipping yourself. That was his religion. Conservatives were told in their heads by God what's right and wrong. Fat Dead Tony was told in his head by the founders what's right and wrong. That part you got. Yep. Lee, yep. Isn't originalism a means of legislation from the bench? Asks Irwin. I'd heard it described as an underhanded way to bypass Congress and the will of the people. Well, if that's what they need to do, it is, Irwin. But from a broad brush basis, what it is a means of doing whatever it is they want to do and crafting the means to the end after they've figured out what the end is going to be. And if it requires the court to do it, then yes. And and they will cloak it and go, oh, this is originalism, this is definitely originalism, while at the same time they work their mischief against the stated will of the Congress and the will of the people of the United States. Like I said, it's a sham. It's a fraud. But it gets cloaked with a bunch of bullshit, phony, intellectual tinsel, and that's how it comes to be respected. Because then it comes also with a bunch of money to make it respectable. Again, that clip.
Politicians, ugly buildings, and whores all get respectable if they last long enough.
And originalism has lasted long enough that, like politicians, ugly buildings, and whores, it's gotten respectable. Even though its intellectual underpinnings make a house of cards built on shifting sands look positively stable. God almighty. And, you know, as Steve in South Carolina stand, or David in South Carolina stand points out, because she is there to do whatever Donald Trump wants her to do, Amy Coney Barrett literally will not say if the president should commit to the peaceful transfer of power. That was one of the more chilling moments. And here's the thing. That's another part of this fraud. Oh, I haven't had a conversation with anyone who's asked me to rule in any particular way, and I haven't told anyone that I would rule. Not a senator, not the president. Oh, if the president ever said anything to me, I'd sure give him a talking to. You know why? Because the deals are made a long time before they ever become elevated to the positions of power they occupy. Amy Coney Barrett, I will tell you, has perjured herself all day long. Here's an example. Missouri Senator Josh Hawley got name-checked earlier today, and not in a good way. Of course, our side won't have the common good sense to use this to its advantage. But the minute I heard it, I went, whoop, what? Josh Hawley of Missouri has publicly stated that he will not vote to confirm a Supreme Court justice. Said this not, you know, long before this even became an issue, or long before she was Amy Coney Barrett was nominated rather. Josh Hawley, who is a good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, homosexual, Christian Republican. In other words, giant screaming hypocrite from Missouri. Josh Hawley said that he absolutely would not ever vote for a Supreme Court nominee who would not say that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided. It's important. Because today, Amy Coney Barrett has repeatedly stated, well, I can't say whether Roe was rightly or wrongly decided. I can just tell you that whatever my personal beliefs are or my political beliefs, I will not take them. I will judge things impartially as a member of the Supreme Court. I promise, swear to God, Hail Mary, whatever. My fingers are crossed. It's important. She says she will not say whether Roe was rightly or wrongly decided, and yet Josh Hawley says he will not vote to confirm a nominee who won't say that Roe was wrongly decided. Well, under that set of circumstances, Josh Hawley of Missouri has no choice but to vote against her confirmation if he is being truthful. Because she made it clear today that she would not say whether Roe was rightly or wrongly decided. That lets her out in terms of Josh Hawley's vote. Unless it was said a long time ago. And she didn't say it to him. She said it to somebody who in turn said it to Josh. And a lot of other Joshes. Oh, you don't have to worry about Amy. Amy's a good handmaid. She'll do as she's told. Look, she signed off on that ad, didn't she? The one where she said that life begins at fertilization? Right? Yeah, Josh, you can trust her. That or she perjured herself all over the place today. I tend to be willing to think she perjured herself. And I wish we had a senator with enough nerve to look at her and say, listen, if I'm here in a few years, and after you're on the court, and you rule exactly the same way we knew you were going to rule, but you swore up and down that you would judge it fairly and impartially, but it turns out you ruled just like your ideology said, I'm going to do everything in my power, lady, to see you impeached for perjury. I'm going to do everything in my power to see you charged with perjury, lady. Because I think you're perjuring yourself right here in this body today. You're under oath, ma'am. Oh, and my God, the pearl clutching and hand wringing that would take place over on the repig licking side. Whew! It'd probably take three margaritas and six Darvons just to get Precious Lindsay calmed down and back out from under the fainting couch. But Senator Harris. Just a minute. Jeremy in Vermont asks, what's our goal again tonight, Bob? Asking for the few and a few hundred. That fundraising goal would be $160. We're trying to raise $160 this evening. We've got about an hour to do it in. Thank you for reminding me, Jeremy. I tend to forget, especially when I get on a roll. Stop it, Bob. Stop it, Bob, says Lee in New York. Amy Tony's Parrott and Roe, Josh Hawley will withhold his vote, you know, just like Lindsay will. It's about the size of it. Let's check in and see if, it'd be great if Kamala Harris would make her cry, but I don't hold out any hope. It's an election year.
Protested to protect their patients' access to the care they desperately need. Together with many of my colleagues, I joined civil rights and community leaders to speak to the thousands of people who gathered outside the Capitol as they pleaded, as they begged with lawmakers to do the right thing. All of these dedicated Americans demanding that their voices be heard. And they made a difference. They made a difference. History will remember that late night, thumbs down movement when the great, great John McCain denied Republicans the opportunity to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And now, following a decade of failure, Washington Republicans have realized that the Affordable Care Act is working too well and helping too many people to repeal it without facing serious political consequences. But what are they doing? After suffering the backlash they provoked by targeting the law in Congress, they decided instead to circumvent voters and try to strike down the Affordable Care Act through the courts. Right now, the Trump administration and Senate Republicans are urging the Supreme Court to strike down the entire Affordable Care Act and all of its patient protections. Republicans are scrambling to confirm this nominee as fast as possible because they need one more Trump judge on the bench before November 10th to win and strike down the entire Affordable Care Act. This is not hyperbole. This is not a hypothetical. This is happening. And here's what you have to know. People are scared. People are scared of what will happen if the Affordable Care Act is destroyed in the middle of a pandemic. There are more than 100 million Americans with pre-existing conditions like asthma and diabetes, heart disease, who know that they could be denied coverage or charged more by insurance companies if Donald Trump is successful in getting rid of the Affordable Care Act. And because of the coronavirus, more than 7 million people have now a pre-existing condition that they didn't have earlier this year. Those who depend on the ACA are afraid of their lives being turned upside down if the court strikes it down. They know what could happen. And Judge Barrett, I will share with you and the American people a list. No protections for pre-existing conditions. Higher costs for health care for women and people over the age of 50. Young adults kicked off their parents' insurance. More expensive prescription drugs for seniors. Insurance companies refusing to cover mental health care. Insurance companies refusing to cover maternity care. No free mammograms, cancer screenings, or birth control. Insurance companies reinstate.
Well, what the hell's a handmaid need with birth control, right?
Losing insurance at the worst possible time, again, in the midst of a pandemic, including nearly 2 million Texans, 607,000 North Carolinians, 288,000 South Carolinians, 227,000 Iowans, and 4.2 million Californians. And the pain of losing these protections would disproportionately be felt among the 9 million African American, Latino, Asian, and Native Americans.
Oh, and by the way, let's just mention one other thing. Lady, I don't care what your priest says to you in the little box with the screen in it, or what your fetus fetish bishop says to you, or, you know, your superior husband says to you. If you're willing to take health care away from 20 million people, you're no follower of Jesus. And if it was up to me, I'd make it clear to you, lady, Amy, that that is a mortal sin from which you will not recover.
For people like Felicia Perez, and this is her. Felicia is a writer, a public speaker, and former high school teacher from Southern California who now teaches at the University of Nevada, Reno. She has multiple pre-existing conditions, including arthritis, asthma, and a rare autoimmune disorder that caused tumors that have wrapped around her optic nerve and part of her brain. Her life depends on periodic cancer-fighting infusions that cost $160,000 a year. Felicia is terrified. She knows that without the...
And Amy says, fuck her!
...ongoing treatment, the treatment she needs to stay alive. And here's exactly what she said, and I will quote. My life is in the hands of people I do not know, who do not know me. who are essentially telling me I don't matter, that my life doesn't matter, that my health doesn't matter, that the day-to-day quality of my life doesn't matter. And that's really hard. Tragically, Felicia's story is not unique. Her fears are shared by millions of Americans. The Affordable Care Act and its protections hinge on this Supreme Court and the outcome of this hearing. Before being elected, President Trump promised that every justice he put forward would, quote, will do the right thing, unlike Bush's appointee, John Roberts, on Obamacare, unquote. Judge Barrett, 18 months later, you criticized the Chief Justice for upholding the Affordable Care Act when you concluded, quote, Chief Justice Roberts pushed the Affordable Care Act beyond its plausible meaning to save the statute. My question is, how many months after you published that article did President Trump nominate you to be a judge on the Court of Appeals?
Senator Harris, I apologize. I don't remember the timing of that article. I was nominated. I believe my nomination to the Court of Appeals was announced in May of 2017.
That's correct.
But I don't remember when the article came out.
The article was published in January of 2017, so that would have been 5 months later. Justice Ginsburg, whose seat you are seeking to fill, provided the critical fifth vote in a 5-4 decision that upheld the Affordable Care Act. So let's lay this out for everyone who's watching. As I've discussed previously, one, Republicans have spent a decade trying to destroy the Affordable Care Act. Two, Donald Trump promised to name a Supreme Court justice and Supreme Court justices who would tear down the Affordable Care Act. Three, President Trump is before the Supreme Court right now arguing that it be struck in its entirety. Four, the Supreme Court could be just one vote away from overturning the Affordable Care Act and all of its protections, including for everyone who has a pre-existing condition or may ever get a pre-existing condition. In other words, the Affordable Care Act and all its protections hinge on this seat and the outcome of this hearing. And I believe it's very important that the American people understand the issues at stake and what's at play. Judge Barrett, the day after President Trump announced your nomination to the Supreme Court, he tweeted, quote, Obamacare will be replaced with a much better and far cheaper alternative if it is terminated in the Supreme Court, end quote. But in reality, there is no alternative that protects the millions of Americans who depend on the Affordable Care Act every day. The horrifying truth is that President Trump and the Republicans in Congress are fighting to take health care away from the American people in the middle of a pandemic, as I have said. President Trump has said that he wants to protect the American people's health care. But the reality is right now he is asking the Supreme Court to take it away, period. Senator Klobuchar, Judge Barrett, asked you earlier today, but did not receive an answer. Prior to your nomination, were you aware of President Trump's statements committing to nominate judges who will strike down the Affordable Care Act? And I'd appreciate a yes or no answer, please.
Well, Senator Harris, I want to be very, very careful. I'm under oath. As I'm sitting here, I don't recall seeing those statements, but I don't recall seeing or hearing those statements, but I don't really know what context they were in.
She's afraid.
So I guess I can't really definitively give you a yes or no answer. What I would like to say is I don't recall hearing about or seeing such statements.
Well, I imagine you were surrounded by a team of folks that helped prepare you for this nomination hearing.
I have
did
had...
They,
yes.
They, well, let me finish if you don't mind.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Did they inform you of the president's statements and that this might be a question that was presented to you during the course of this hearing?
When I had my calls with senators, it came up. Many of Many of
That's
the
not the question she asked.
Wanted to know about the Affordable Care Act and to satisfy themselves that I had not made any pre-commitments to the president about it.
And so you then became aware of the president's statement, is that correct?
Let's see, Senator Harris.
Oh shit, she's cross-examining her.
I honestly can't remember whether senators framed the questions in the context of President Trump's comments. Perhaps so. I think from my perspective, the most important thing is to say that I have never made a commitment, I've never been asked to make a commitment, and I hope that the committee would trust in my integrity not to even entertain such an idea, and I wouldn't violate my oath if I were confirmed and heard that case.
So just so I'm clear, and then we can move on, are you saying that you are now, before I said it, aware or not aware that President Trump made these comments about who he would nominate to the United States Supreme Court?
All right, Senator Harris, what I was saying, I thought you initially framed the question as whether I was aware before this nomination process began. And my answer to that question
is, if you are aware, were you aware before this hearing began?
So you're changing, you're asking me now whether I was aware before the hearing began?
As a follow-up question, I am, yes.
And what I said was that when I had my calls with Democratic senators, this question came up, and I don't recall, but it may well have been, that they referenced those comments in the course of those calls. Even if so, that wasn't something that I heard or saw directly by reading it myself.
Senator Leahy asked you earlier today, but I think it bears repeating. Do you think it is important for the American people to believe that Supreme Court justices are independent and fair and impartial? And that is a yes or no answer, please.
Yes, Senator Harris.
A number of my colleagues have asked you today whether you would recuse yourself from cases on the Affordable Care Act. You did not directly answer their questions, and instead you described a process by which that would work or happen. And so my question is, isn't it true that at the end of that process, regardless of that process, that it would be you who ultimately would make the decision about whether or not you would recuse yourself?
That is true, and I can't have you elicit a commitment from me about how I would make that decision in advance. That would be wrong.
Right, and what I've asked you is that is it not correct that that is the process, that ultimately it would be you and you alone that would make the decision about whether you would be recused? You've already opined on the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, and that position satisfied the president's promise to only nominate judges who would tear down the Affordable Care Act. And Senate Republicans rushed this process so that you could rule on this very case. The reasonable question about your impartiality will undoubtedly hang over this court's ultimate decision in the Affordable Care Act case if you refuse to recuse yourself. I strongly believe that. Supreme Court justices routinely consider the consequences of their decisions on people's lives. Earlier this year, the Supreme Court ruled against President Trump in his effort to repeal DACA protections for Dreamers, children, of course, who have arrived in the United States, many before they could talk or walk. Chief Justice Roberts wrote the opinion for a 5-4 majority that included the crucial vote of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The court rejected the Trump administration's attempt to end protections for Dreamers. Chief Justice Roberts said the administration had not taken into consideration the fact that many Dreamers relied on those protections when they started their careers and businesses, when they served in the military of the United States, when they bought homes, and when they started families. Senator Hirono asked you whether it is appropriate for a Supreme Court justice to consider real-world impacts. But you're a sitting judge now, so my question is, in deciding whether to uphold government action, do you currently consider the consequences of your rulings on people's lives?
Well, Senator Harris, that's part of the decision of every case.
And so you do?
Every case has consequences on people's lives, so of course I do in every case. That's part of the judicial decision-making process.
And would you do that as if you are actually voted on the United States Supreme Court? Would you do that there as well?
Senator, considering how the resolution of
can't give
a
straight answer
will affect parties, will affect people, is part of the judicial decision-making process, and I will continue engaging in that process to the best of my ability.
And by the way, I have resisted the urge to say anything about her voice, but she has a she has a machine-like quality. Have you noticed?
And cancer would pay more for insurance or be denied coverage entirely. More than 20 million Americans could lose their health coverage entirely, including nearly 3 million Black Americans and over 5 million Latino Americans who received access to health insurance because of the Affordable Care Act. Insurers will once again be able to discriminate against that more than 50% of African Americans and nearly 40% of Latinos with pre-existing conditions. Insurers will be able to deny coverage to more than one quarter of Native Americans with conditions like diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. All of this in the midst of a pandemic that is not going away anytime soon. A pandemic that, when age is taken into account, has been three times as deadly for Black, Latino, Pacific Islander, and Native Americans. A pandemic that has killed approximately 1 in 1,000 Black Americans, 1 in 1,200 Native Americans, and 1 in 1,500 Latino Americans. Judge Barrett, would you consider the 135 million people who gained protections under the Affordable Care Act when deciding a case that challenges that law?
Senator Harris, if I were to be confirmed and conclude that I was able to sit on the case pursuant to the recusal statute, and then if I heard the case and decided the case, I would consider all the protections that Congress put in place. And as I said earlier during this hearing, the question would be figuring out whether Congress, assuming that the mandate is unconstitutional now, whether that, consistent with your intent, you know, this is Congress's law, would permit this act to stand, or whether the flawed portion of it could just be excised out. And that is a question not of what judges want. It's not a question of the Supreme Court. It's a question of what Congress wanted in the statute. And that is the statute, you know, that you enacted and extended this health care coverage to millions of Americans.
What weight would you give the fact that 135 million Americans with pre-existing conditions are now depending on the protections of the Affordable Care Act? What weight would you give that?
Well, Senator Harris, as I mentioned to Senator Hirono, stare decisis takes reliance interests into account because, as I've said before, stare decisis is about keeping stability in the law. So the law often takes into account reliance interests. I can't really say, sitting here, how they would play in or way in this case, because that's part of the legal calculus of the case. So I can't really give you the kind of commitment or pre-commitment that you're asking from me of how I would weigh factors or how I would structure my decision-making process.
What do you want to bet Brett Kavanaugh is sitting in his study back there at that house that the mortgage was paid for by somebody we don't know but wasn't Brett Kavanaugh? And maybe Mrs. Kavanaugh's off with the children somewhere, and Brett Kavanaugh's got him one of them little mini kegs of beer, and he's hoisting a tankard and sitting there and jacking off for all he's worth, because, man, they're going to fuck some people when they get Amy on the bench.
It's a personal matter. She was a trailblazer for women's equality and gender equity. As a law student, as a teacher, as a civil rights lawyer, and as a second woman ever to sit on the United States Supreme Court, Justice Ginsburg broke many barriers for women across the country. We, I believe, all fondly remember her as a person.
And don't you know Amy goes home at the end of the day and says, Justice Ginsburg, Justice Ginsburg. She draws that fucking Justice Ginsburg like a goddamn gun. How am I ever supposed to be a famous historical Supreme Court justice when I gotta follow that woman? I'm going to have to fuck some people real hard. I'm going to have to prove to them that a woman can be just as nasty and hateful and vicious and bloodthirsty as fat, my hero, fat, dead Tony Scalia himself.
And it protects a woman's right to choose abortion. Women of color, immigrant women, women with low incomes, and women in rural areas face significant barriers when attempting to access birth control, cancer screenings, and comprehensive reproductive health care. Moreover, anti-choice activists and politicians have been working for decades to pass laws and file lawsuits designed to...
Let's check in with a couple of emails. Cynthia in the Bay Area says, has anyone asked Amy what she thinks about bearing false witness? She's surely going to burn in hell if she lies through her teeth before the Lord God.
No, she's going to be forgiven. And there will be candles lit and burnt and shit.
Angelo in the People's Republic of the Bronx says, now I remember where I remember that voice from. From the TV show Becker, the ditzy receptionist Linda, played by Shawnee Smith. Oh, dear. Let's see.
Not what I'm feeling.
Kris Kringle, you're up next. Hey, Santa, come on, let's get a move on. Linda, do me a favor. Go over there and wake up Santa and tell him to get his big red butt back to room two.
Santa! Santa, it's time to see the doctor. Santa, your reindeer need you.
Margaret, I think we have a problem.
Hold on, please.
What is it?
Well, I think that Santa's dead.
I want a truck.
Oh, dear. Hey, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. Pretty good, Angela. Darlene in Connecticut pointing out, Amy Tony's parrot lied straight out of the gates when she said in her opening statement, I think it was, that she never wanted to be a U.S. Supreme Court justice. She alluded to the appearance of impropriety in terms of recusal if Trump should bring a challenge to the election results before the SCOTUS. The appearance of impropriety is already there. Because it's about the appearance, not the actual. It already exists even before she's even been confirmed. She needs to state that she will recuse herself, plain and simple. P.S. I just started listening about 30 minutes ago as I was in a Zoom meeting. It's pretty clear that Amy knew nothing about the ACA. She knew nothing. I know nothing. Patrick Leahy's questioning earlier today revealed this. Her lack of knowledge about how many Americans are in the ACA, among other basic facts, was absolutely appalling and evidence of willful ignorance. She doesn't care, precisely. She and her family are not in the ACA, but she's getting government health care as a judge. Guaranteed, the best around. She's employing all the tricks, including Clarence Thomas's trick of refusing to look at the charges Anita Hill laid before the committee about his sexual harassment of her all those years ago. Oh, it's like magic, isn't it? Billable Rick said, am I the only one who found the atrocious ACB's voice obnoxiously nasally and robotic? Also, was she really speaking while giving those rote answers, or was someone behind her pulling the string and making her mouth move? Where have you gone, Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy? You gotta hand it to them, says Matt in San Francisco. Love them or hate them, I hate them. You have to give the right-wingers credit. They've pushed the discussion so far to the right, the Democrats are fighting to keep a fragile hold on a Republican health plan. My head spins when I try to understand how we got here. Yeah. And this is another one of those moments. We got to have the House. We got to have the Senate. We got to have Joe Biden. And then we got to come up with a health care plan all over again, just so she and the judicial vandals can trash it, too. Eventually, they'll get around to just putting Americans up against a wall and machine-gunning them, because fascists usually do find their way to that. David in South Carolina, Stan, pointing out the individual mandate. So the Republican piece of the ACA is what she's going to hang her decision to kill the ACA on? By Jove, I think he's got it. Excising the bad part of the ACA, Lee in New York says, Bob, do you think the bad part of the ACA is the whole thing? Oh, by Jove, he's got it too. Well, now. Amy Tony's parrot, Billable Rick, says the atrocious ACB's voice, cadence, and mannerisms prove the thesis of Alex Jones that human-animal hybrids are real.
God, Billable can get me in trouble.
Yeah, that's the thing. Irwin says, thanks for the answer. Taking the desired answer and working backwards from a feasible solution was a common method in engineering to make the best possible design to fit standards criteria. This method could be abused in engineering as well, as it sometimes resulted in under-designing. It is obviously different in law, and I see a problem it would present in law as the judge. Thanks for clarifying the sham of originalism. It really is worse than I thought. It's certainly an old whore by now. And that, yeah, precisely, again.
Politicians, ugly buildings, and whores all get respectable if they last long enough.
Probably ought to get that tattooed or somewhere on me. And, yeah, well, originalism's old enough. You're right. You're right, Irwin. Let's see. Let's run over and check in real quick with Dave in the Blind. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Bob. Is originalism old enough for Donald Trump to date?
Nah, it's old. It's so old now, he's not interested. He doesn't even want to grab originalism by the...
Oh, okay. In other words, it's over the age of 12. Okay.
Wait a minute. I got to give you a cowbell for working that bit. You worked it like a pro.
I try. I've been a comedian since I was 7. I had an interesting experience several years ago when a sitting Supreme Court Justice of the United States said that no amendment to the Constitution was absolute. And he mentioned an early case of a man who had carried around a battle axe around town, and the state courts told him he couldn't do it, and it got all the way up to the Supreme Court. And he said that they rightly judged that you couldn't have a weapon of intimidation. That Supreme Court justice was the then wife, now dead, Fat Tony Scalia. So he did not believe in originalism. He believed in fitting what he wanted to the case at hand. And he called it originalism to give it a veneer of
respectability. Exactly.
And I mean, when I was in school studying history, the era of the early Republic and the Constitutional Convention was a fascinating time for me. So I listened to Fat Dead Tony on this, and I thought, and I said, you know what? He's right. The cases, especially the early cases, were the kinds of things that, well, if I've got the freedom to do this, and then the government goes, no, actually you don't. Because a lot of it was common sense. In the case of the battle axe, it was common sense you didn't want a guy just walking around town with a battle axe in hand. And it amazes me. I mean, it doesn't surprise me, but it amazes me that these people still think that they're upholding the Constitution. The Constitution was always designed to adapt. That's why we had amendments and the ability to propose amendments. And there are 28 of them now? 27 or 28? The last amendment to be approved was originally part of the original Bill of Rights, that said you could not have You there?
Yep.
Oh, okay. That you could not have raises for federal judges and members of Congress before the following Congress, because the idea was you had to stand for election if you voted yourself a raise. Well, that didn't get into the original. I mean, it was written up in the original Bill of Rights, but it was one of those amendments that was not approved. But it was brought back in the 80s, and it went through. This working backwards is a common tactic for the Republicans. They justify it by saying, well, we'll do this because we're fair. I'm thinking more along the lines of Precious Lindsay, who couldn't tell the truth if his life depended on it. And evidently, his political life is holding on by a thread. But I saw something today that gave me hope. They have early voting here in Indiana now.
Okay.
And the city county council building in Indianapolis is a fairly good sized building. Takes up an entire city block. And the line for early voting was out to the street. And it covered a plaza that's in front of the building.
The only problem is the only problem is how long was the wait? And how many booths were there? Because we saw massive lines in Georgia yesterday.
I'll be finding out tomorrow because Christine's bringing my wheelchair out of storage so that we can wait in line.
Well, you might take a page from our buddy Randy's book. Not trying to be gross or anything, but. You might want to load up with a couple of Depends.
Ooh, I hadn't thought of that. That is a good idea, Bob.
That actually comes from protest teachings. People who were planning on doing a sit-in and getting arrested, civil disobedience, were warned that it's gonna be a while. So you double depend.
Oh, okay. So I can double sleep. That's not a problem. That's not a problem. I'll just let Chris know we need to go to the drugstore and grab a set of Depends, or a couple sets of Depends, and get me prepared. And I'm going to be taking a couple bottles of water with me because it looked like it was at least a two-hour wait. Now, I'm fortunate the weather's cool enough early in the morning. But, again, they were stretched around the building. They were stretched around the building on Saturday. People in Indiana are really taking the early voting seriously, far more seriously than I've ever seen them take it. Because traditionally in Indiana, we vote on election day. I mean, there are people who obviously work that day or need to do the early voting or the absentee voting for various reasons. And that's cool. I've done that. I mean, my mobility is not the world's greatest, so I've had to absentee vote a couple times in a row. I get a letter from the State Board of Elections questioning whether I am who I say I am. But the envelope that they give, or the form they give me, has all my personal information not secured by an envelope. And I called them and they said, well, we can send it in for you. And I'm like, no, that's not the point. The point is you're expecting me to send it through the mail to you where anybody can see the information. I said, how was it I was chosen? And they said, everybody in Indiana got one. Well, I put pavement to that. Like, I asked her if she'd gotten one. No. And I did not fill it out. I've checked with my county ever since, and they have not taken my name off the voter registration roll, because that's what the state was threatening to do. And I think I would have had a pretty good case saying they were violating the security of my information as the reason I didn't send it in. So I just had to call because a lot of people are like, well, Antonin Scalia was an originalist and he was this, that, and the other. He was a lying little hypocrite who would fit it the way he wanted to.
Right. It's all originalism is just better than saying Machiavellianism, okay? But Dave, you take.
But my at least Uncle Niccolo was honest about it.
Well, that's true.
He didn't make any bones about it.
You get a cowbell. I think that's the first time I've ever heard Machiavelli referred to as Uncle Niccolo on any radio program, and I'm just glad it happened here, Dave.
Well, it just shows the educational level of our family, you know, that we have people who actually know the guy's name was Niccolo. but the thing is, these guys, her voice is like Trump's. If I never hear it again, it'll be too soon. Unfortunately, she's only, what, 42?
48.
48? Almost as bad.
She's had 57 children, and that takes a little time off of you.
Well, not if you adopt them all. No.
She only adopted two. She needed to adopt two
non-Caucasian?
Two box checkers. She adopted a couple of box checkers.
Oh, I see. Well, you know, every good right-wing family needs at least two.
Well, that meant that they wouldn't be adopted by any of those homosexuals.
Well, now, Bob, since Sunday was National Coming Out Day, I began to wonder why Mike Pence was quiet all day.
Hey, Dave, I got to roll because I do want to run the Sheldon Whitehouse audio. I think it's important enough that it merits being preserved for like all time or something.
Go for it.
All right. Thanks.
I'll talk to you later, Bob.
Hey, say hi to the guys down at the shop.
I will, and I'll tell Christine you said hello too.
Absolutely. Do please. Later now. Our buddy Dave calling from Talibandiana. And just a reminder, because I'm sure Jeremy would want me to, we've got $160 to go in fundraising just to finish off this evening because Colin last night made it a little bit easier for us this evening. And it would be great if it wasn't, $360 tomorrow. Note from Gary, I voted in Iroquois County, Illinois, early voting today, much easier than early voting in Texas where I voted for the last 10 years. Well, I think that's because in Illinois they want you to vote, Gary. They're not so crazy about you voting in Texas, especially if you're not going to vote the right way. Real hope in Indiana, Jeremy says to Dave in Talibandiana, would be the state striking all mention of Pence as the state's favorite son. So anyway, I want to go back to the remarks of Sheldon Whitehouse today, because he really did put on a master class. And by the way, before I do that, just a quick note, thanks to Joy in Ann Arbor. I said that Amy Tony's parrot had already perjured herself. Well, she has. Joy noting, God hates a liar, sweetie.
I have never discriminated on the basis of sexual preference and would never discriminate on the basis of sexual preference.
Amy Coney Barrett sat on the board of a school that refused to accept the children of same-sex couples. Unmarried at the time automatically meant LGBTQQIA couples. Yep, there it is. She served from 2015 to 2017 on the board of the Trinity School. Huh, Trinity. How about that? And in 2014, the board of the trustees of Trinity Schools Incorporated, which also runs two other schools, adopted a policy not to accept children of unmarried couples. Unmarried, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Unmarried, you know, gay-like couples. Yeah, so much for not discriminating, right? Right. Disgusting. Arnold in PA pointing out, I think it's disturbing that a 48-year-old American woman can't answer a goddamn question. Mm-hmm. And adds, Cory Booker, Senator Booker is a corporate Dem. The fact that that he's actually making me feel good right now with his questioning makes it a depressing state of affairs. Well, Maybe, Arnold, a few less purity tests and just recognizing that we're not always going to agree on everything all the time, we might make a little bit more progress. I don't know. Hey, thanks for jumping back in, Jeremy, as two out of the few this evening. I mean, Jeremy is the few this evening. We're at 155 to go in fundraising. Thank you. Thank you, Jeremy. Now, back to Sheldon Whitehouse, because this is important. Because somebody put in a lot of damn work to connect all the dots to show exactly how our judicial system has been corrupted by right-wing money and right-wing ideology. Remember what I said when I was talking about originalism and the origins of originalism? And one of the things, and you know, anytime a Republican finds a way to make a dollar, they're going to find a way to make a million of them. They're good at it. But here's the thing. When it turned to an issue of these religious, social horseshit triggers that make Republicans reach for their wallets, they're past masters. And so it is that Sheldon Whitehouse today put on a masterclass and showed step by step, breadcrumb by breadcrumb, exactly how this process has been perverted and converted into a right wing, just a right wing swamp fest.
Telephone. You were kind enough to hear out a presentation that I made, and I intend to ask some questions in that area, but it doesn't make sense to ask questions if I haven't laid the predicate, particularly for viewers who are watching this. So I guess the reason that I want to do this is because people who are watching this need to understand that this small hearing room and the little TV box that you're looking at, the little screen that you're looking at, are a little bit like the frame of a puppet theater. And if you only look at what's going on in the puppet theater, you're not going to understand the whole story. You're not going to understand the real dynamic of what is going on here. And you're certainly not going to understand forces outside of this room who are pulling strings and pushing sticks and causing the puppet theater to react. So first, let me say, why do I think outside forces are here pulling strings? Well, part of it is behavior. We have colleagues here who supported you, this nominee, before there was a nominee. That's a little unusual. We have the political ram job that we have already complained of, driving this process through at breakneck speed in the middle of a pandemic while the Senate is closed for safety reasons and while we're doing nothing about the COVID epidemic around us. We have some very awkward 180s from colleagues. Mr. Chairman, you figure in this. Our leader said back when it was Garland versus Gorsuch that of course the American people should have a say in the court's direction. Of course, said Mitch McConnell. That's long gone. Senator Grassley said the American people shouldn't be denied a voice. That's long gone. Senator Cruz said you don't do this in an election year. That's long gone. And our chairman made his famous hold the tape promise, if an opening comes in the last year of President Trump's term, we'll wait till the next election. That's gone too. So there is a lot of hard to explain hypocrisy and rush taking place right now. And my experience around politics is that when you find hypocrisy in the daylight, look for power in the shadows.
Ooh.
Now, people may say, well, what does all this matter? This is a political parlor game. It's no big deal. Well, there are some pretty high stakes here that we've been talking about here on our side. And I'll tell you three of them right here. Roe versus Wade, Obergefell, and the Obamacare cases. Here's the GOP platform, the Republican platform, the platform of my colleagues on the other side of this aisle say that a Republican president will appoint judges who will reverse Roe, Obergefell, and the Obamacare cases. So if you have a family member with an interest in some autonomy over their body under Roe versus Wade, the ability to have a marriage, to have friends marry, to have a niece or a daughter or a son marry someone of their same sex, you've got a stake. And if you're one of the millions and millions of Americans who depend on the Affordable Care Act, you've got a stake. It's not just the platform. Over and over again, let's start by talking about the Affordable Care Act. Here's the president talking about this litigation that we're gearing up this nominee for November 10th. In this litigation, he said, we want to terminate health care under Obamacare. That is the president's statement. So when we react to that, don't act as if we're making this stuff up. This is what President Trump said. This is what your party platform says. Reverse the Obamacare cases. Senator after senator, including many in this committee, filed briefs saying that the Affordable Care Act should be thrown out by courts. Why is it surprising for us to be concerned that you want this nominee to do what you want nominees to do? One quick stop on NFIB v. Sebelius, because a lot of this has to do with money. This is an interesting comparison. National Federation of Independent Businesses, until it filed the NFIB versus Sebelius case,
this is the beginning,
had its biggest donation ever of $21,000. In the year that it went to work on the Affordable Care Act, 10 wealthy donors gave $10 million. Somebody deserves a thank you. So let's go on to Roe v. Wade. Same thing. The president has said that reversing Roe v. Wade will happen automatically because he's putting pro-life justices on the court. Why would we not take him at his word? The Republican Party platform says it will reverse Roe. Why would we not comment on that and take you at your word? Senators here, including Senator Hawley, have said, I will vote only for nominees who acknowledge that Roe v. Wade is wrongly decided. And they're pledged to vote for this nominee. Do the math. That's a really simple equation to run. The Republican brief in June Medical said Roe should be overruled. So don't act surprised when we ask questions about whether that's what you're up to here. And finally, out in the ad world that you have spared yourself, wisely, Judge Barrett, the Susan B. Anthony Foundation is running advertisements right now saying that you are set. You are set to give our pro-life country the court that it deserves. There's the ad with the voiceover. She's set. She's set. And then Roe, Obamacare cases, and Obergefell, gay marriage. National Organization for Marriage, the big group that opposes same-sex marriage, says in this proceeding, all our issues are at stake. Republican platform says it wants to reverse Obergefell. And the Republican brief filed in the case said same-sex relationships don't fall within any constitutional protection. So when we say the stakes are high on this, it's because you've said the stakes are high on this. You have said that's what you want to do. So how are people going about doing it? What is the scheme here? Let me start with this one. In all cases, there's big anonymous money behind various lanes of activity. One lane of activity is through the conduit of the Federalist Society. It's managed by a guy, was managed by a guy named Leonard Leo, and it's taken over the selection of judicial nominees. How do we know that to be the case? Because Trump has said so over and over again. His White House counsel said so. So we have an anonymously funded group controlling judicial selection run by this guy, Leonard Leo. Then in another lane, we have, again, anonymous funders running through something called the Judicial Crisis Network, which is run by Carrie Severino, and it's doing PR and campaign ads for Republican judicial nominees. It got $17 million donation in the Garland Gorsuch contest. It got another single $17 million donation to support Kavanaugh. Somebody, perhaps the same person, spent $35 million to influence the makeup of the United States Supreme Court. Tell me that's good. And then over here, you have a whole array of legal groups, also funded by dark money, which have a different role. They bring cases to the court. They don't wind their way to the court, Your Honor. They get shoved to the court by these legal groups, many of which ask to lose below so they can get quickly to the court to get their business done there. And then they turn up in an orchestrated chorus of amici. Now, I've had a chance to have a look at this, and I was in a case, actually, as an amicus myself, the Consumer Financial Protection Board case. And in that case, there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 amicus briefs filed And every single one of them was a group funded by something called Donors Trust. Donors Trust is a gigantic identity scrubbing device for the right wing.
You might want to jot down some of these names.
Donors Trust is the donor without whoever the real donor is. It doesn't have a business. It doesn't have a business plan. It doesn't do anything. It's just an identity scrubber. And this group here, the Bradley Foundation, funded 8 out of the 11 briefs. That seems weird to me when you have amicus briefs coming in, little flotillas that are funded by the same groups but nominally separate in the court. So I actually attached this to my brief as an appendix. Center for Media and Democracy saw it, and they did better work. They went on to say which foundations funded the brief writers in that CFPB case. Here's the Bradley Foundation for $5.6 million to those groups. Here's Donors Trust, $23 million to those brief writing groups. The grand total across all the donor groups was $68 million to the groups that were filing amicus briefs, pretending that they were different groups. And it's not just in the Consumer Financial Protection Board case. You might say, well, that was just a one-off. Here's Janus, the anti-labor case.
Nope.
It had a long trail through the court, through Friedrichs and through Knox and through other decisions. And SourceWatch and ProPublica did some work about this. Here's Donors Trust and Donors Capital Fund. And here's the Bradley Foundation. And they totaled giving $45 million to the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 groups that filed amicus briefs pretending to be different groups. And both of the lawyer groups in the case.
Pretending to be different groups. That's a fraud on the court.
Trust, funded by Bradley Foundation and Janus. This is happening over and over and over again. And it goes beyond just the briefs. It goes beyond just the amicus presentations. The Federalist Society. Remember this group that is acting as the conduit and that Donald Trump has said is doing his judicial selection? They're getting money from the same foundations. From Donors Trust, $16.7 million. From the Bradley Foundation, $1.37 million. From the same group of foundations total, $33 million. So you can start to look at these, and you can start to tie them together. The legal groups. All the same funders over and over again, bringing the cases and providing this orchestrated chorus of amici. Then the same group also funds the Federalist Society over here. The Washington Post wrote a big expose about this, and that made Leonard Leo a little hot, a little bit like a burned agent. So he had to jump out, and he went off to go and do anonymously funded voter suppression work. Guess who jumped in to take over the selection process in this case for Judge Barrett? Carrie Severino made the hop. So once again, ties right in together. So Center for Media and Democracy has done a little bit more research. Here's a Bradley Foundation memo that they've published. The Bradley Foundation is reviewing a grant application asking for money for this orchestrated amicus process. And what do they say in the staff recommendation? It is important to orchestrate, their word, not mine, important to orchestrate high-caliber amicus efforts before the court. They also note that Bradley has done previous philanthropic investments in the actual underlying legal actions. So Bradley is funding, what do they call, philanthropically investing in the underlying legal action and then giving money to groups to show up in the orchestrated chorus of amici. That can't be good. And it goes on, because they also found this email. This email comes from an individual at the Bradley Foundation, and it asks our friend Leonard Leo, who used to run the selection process, is there a 501c3 nonprofit to which Bradley could direct any support of the two Supreme Court amicus projects other than Donors Trust? I don't know why they wanted to avoid the reliable identity scrubber donors trust, but for some reason they did. So Leonard Leo writes back, on Federalist Society address. So don't tell me that it isn't Federalist Society business. On Federalist Society, on his address, he writes back, yes, send it to the Judicial Education Project, which could take and allocate the money. And guess who works for the Judicial Education Project?
Gary Severino?
Severino.
Of course, Gary Severino.
Who also helped select this nominee running the Trump Federalist Society selection process.
You could almost say Gary Severino was the handmaid to Amy Coney Barrett.
Questions abound. In the Washington Post article, they point out that the Judicial Crisis Network's office is on the same hallway in the same building as the Federalist Society, and that when they sent their reporter to talk to somebody at the Judicial Crisis Network, somebody from the Federalist Society came down to let them up. This more and more looks like it's not three schemes, but it's one scheme, with the same funders selecting judges, funding campaigns for the judges, and then showing up in court in these orchestrated amicus flotillas to tell the judges what to do. On the Judicial Crisis Network, you've got the Leonard Leo connection. Obviously, she hopped in to take over for him with the Federalist Society. You've got the campaigns that I've talked about, where they take $17 million contributions. That's a big check to write, $17 million. To campaign for Supreme Court nominees. No idea who that is or what they got for it. You've got briefs that she wrote. The Republican senators filed briefs in that NFIB case signed by Ms. Severino. The woman who helped choose this nominee has written briefs for Republican senators attacking the ACA. Don't say the ACA is not an issue here. And by the way, the Judicial Crisis Network funds the Republican Attorneys General. It funds RAGA, the Republican Attorney General's Association, and it funds individual Republican attorneys.
And when they cut away to a picture, to a shot of Amy Coney's parrot, she's looking at Sheldon Whitehouse like if looks could kill, he'd go away in a basket.
So he's in with the Republican Attorneys General, but here's the Judicial Crisis Network campaigning for Supreme Court nominees, writing briefs for senators against the Affordable Care Act, supporting the Republicans who are bringing this case and leading the selection process for this nominee. Here's the page off the brief. Here's where they are. Mitch McConnell and on through the list. Senator Collins, Senator Cornyn, Senator Hovind, Senator, who's still here?
Rand Paul.
Marco Rubio. It's a huge assortment of Republican senators who Carrie Severino wrote a brief for against the Affordable Care Act. So this is a, to me, pretty big deal. I've never seen this around any court that I've ever been involved with, where there's this much dark money and this much influence being used. Here's how the Washington Post summed it up. This is a conservative activist behind-the-scenes campaign to remake the nation's courts, and it's a $250 million dark money operation. $250 million is a lot of money to spend if you're not getting anything for it. So that raises the question, what are they getting for it? Well, I showed the slide earlier on the Affordable Care Act and on Obergefell and on Roe versus Wade.
Here comes the axe handle.
That's where they lost. But with another and on Roe versus Wade, that's where they lost. But with another judge, that could change. That's where the contest is. That's where the Republican Party platform tells us to look at how they want judges to rule, to reverse Roe, to reverse the Obamacare cases, and to reverse Obergefell and take away gay marriage. That is their stated objective and plan. Why not take them at their word? But there's another piece of it, and that is not what's ahead of us, but what's behind us. What's behind us is now 80 cases, Mr. Chairman, 80 cases under Chief Justice Roberts that have these characteristics. One, they were decided 5-4 by a bare majority. Two, the 5-4 majority was partisan in the sense that not one Democratic appointee joined the five. I refer to that group as the Roberts Five. It changes a little bit, as with Justice Scalia's death, for instance, but there's been a steady Roberts Five that has delivered now 80 of these decisions. And the last characteristic of them is that there is an identifiable Republican donor interest in those cases. And in every single case, that donor interest won. It was an 80-0, 5-4 partisan rout, ransacking.
80 cases bought and paid for.
And it's important to look at where those cases went, because they're not about big public issues like getting rid of the Affordable Care Act, undoing Roe versus Wade, and undoing same-sex marriage.
And by the way, they cut away to Precious Lindsay for just a minute, and he had a look of pure, unmitigated hatred in his little beady hooded eyes. All those Republicans caught, busted. A judicial system caught, busted. This is why I said it was so important to run this audio this evening. Because at least with this, you know, with this program, you can go back and forth and you can jot down the names and everything. And because we've spent so long, the Koch brothers, I'm sure they're in there somewhere. But God, the conspiracy is so much more broad and so much more deep. And we are further into it than anyone can imagine. I have never seen this thing put together this way, the way that Senator Sheldon Whitehouse did today, and bless him for it. Oh, yeah. I mean, this is a financial war on our constitutional republic. And thank you very kindly. Thank you to John for jumping in, and thank you to Charlene, and thank you to Trevor. That takes us down to 95 bucks to go to finish the evening. Oh, 85. Thank you to Thomas Jug of Punch, our buddy. Thank you. Jeremy in Vermont says, oh my God, I almost forgot to say Keith Olbermann owned Donnie last night about taking remdesivir. He said, did anyone else notice how many times he said remdesivir in the past few days in crazy videos, mentioned how up until 2017, possible 18, Trump was a stockholder in the company? He also stated he said it so much there should have been an 800 number attached to the speech and offer for a free sleep pillow if you order now. It's all part of it. This is, remember what Moscow Mitch named his autobiography, his memoir. The long game. But Sheldon Whitehouse exposed it. And maybe, if we can take back the Senate, hold the House, and take the presidency, maybe there's a chance to reverse some of this. Oh, we're getting catty late in the game. JR says, why does every frock the handmaid dons look like sackcloth rinsed in writ? Whew, that's brutal. And Billable Rick said, ACB's originalism. Ha! In case you've not covered it, while driving today, I heard Amy Toney's parrot explain why she dissented from a Seventh Circuit opinion holding that an individual convicted of multiple felony counts of Medicare fraud could be convicted as a felon in possession of a firearm. The parrot dummy and another dissenting judge in that case found that the defendant could be considered as being a felon for purposes of the federal statute barring felons from possessing or owning firearms only if he had been convicted of a violent felony. However, that statute contains no language qualifying or limiting its application only to certain types of felonies, such as violent felonies. Under the plain language doctrine, a cousin doctrine to originalism, but it's actually a real doctrine, a judge is supposed to discern the meaning of a statute based only on the language used and not add his or her interpretation or gloss to the statute. It would appear that the Parrott exception to the plain language doctrine is that such doctrine is inapplicable where it would limit the ability of citizens or even convicted criminals to own freedom protectors. Citizens United, as to Senator Whitehouse's remarks, Citizens United, says David in South Carolina, Stan, bingo. Shorty in L.A. says, hit the streets ASAP. Get in the streets ASAP. What the fuck? Graham and Grassley refuse to be tested. We have to stop staying at home in our minds and in our emotions and our emotional spirit and our cosmic connectivity to the globe. Nowhere on planet Earth have we not been connected as human beings. Understand, as Mr. Whitehouse spoke, Senator Graham and Grassley refused to be tested for the coronavirus before the hearing. Oh, yeah, and Mike Plague Rat Lee, who also has no negative test results. Mike Plague Rat Lee was sitting there barking and grunting and hooting and spewing and spraying viral particles all over the room. It'll be a miracle if they don't all come down dead. From the Des Moines Register, Senator Chuck Grassley won't seek coronavirus test after attending meeting with infected senator. Oh, Jesus is going to protect him. JR says, I learned that bit about every frock looks like a sackcloth rinsed in writ. I said, caddy. JR said, I learned that from the same girls who'd tell a bitch to go brush her hair. Go brush your hair, Barrett. And there's the Lindy and Harry Bradley Foundation.
The Bradley Foundation envisions a nation invigorated by the principles and institutions that uphold our unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Oh, I don't think so. Or maybe it's a different Bradley Foundation. I don't know. That's going to take a little more digging about. So let's let Senator Whitehouse continue with his damning, crushing brief against the dark forces that brought Amy Coney Barrett to this point in her privileged existence.
They're about power. And if you look at those 80 decisions, they fall into four categories over and over and over again. One, unlimited and dark money in politics. Citizens United is the famous one, but it's continued since with McCutcheon, and we've got one coming up now. Always the five, four, unlimited money in politics, never protecting against dark money in politics, despite the fact that they said it was going to be transparent. And who wins when you allow unlimited dark money in politics? A very small group. The ones who have unlimited money to spend and a motive to spend it in politics. They win, everybody else loses. And if you're looking at who might be behind this, let's talk about people with unlimited money to spend and a motive to do it. We'll see how that goes. Next, knock the civil jury down. Whittle it down to a nub. The civil jury was in the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights, in our darn Declaration of Independence. But it's annoying to big corporate powers because you can swagger your way as a big corporate power through Congress. You can go and tell the president you put money into to elect what to do. He'll put your stooges at the EPA. It's all great until you get to the civil jury because they have an obligation, as you know, Judge Barrett. They have an obligation under the law to be fair to both parties, irrespective of their size. You can't bribe them. You're not allowed to. It's a crime to tamper with a jury. It's standard practice to tamper with Congress.
Oh!
and they make decisions based on the law. If you're used to being the boss and swaggering your way around the political side, you don't want to be answerable before a jury. And so one after another, these 85-4 decisions have knocked down, whittled away at the civil jury, a great American institution. Third, first was unlimited dark money. Second was demean and diminish the civil jury. Third is weaken regulatory agencies. A lot of this money, I'm convinced, is polluter money. The Coke Industries is a polluter.
There they are.
The fossil fuel industry is a polluter.
Coal companies.
Who else would be putting buckets of money into
this? Frackers.
And wanting to hide who they are behind donors' trust or other schemes. And what if you're a big polluter, what do you want? You want weak regulatory agencies. You want ones that you can box up and run over to Congress and get your friends to fix things for you in Congress. Over and over and over again, these decisions are targeted at regulatory agencies to weaken their independence and weaken their strength. And if you're a big polluter, a weak regulatory agency is your idea of a good day. And the last thing is in politics, in voting. Why on earth the court made the decision a factual decision, not something appellate courts are ordinarily supposed to make, as I understand it, Judge Barrett, the factual decision that nobody needed to worry about minority voters in preclearance states being discriminated against or that legislators would try to knock back their ability to vote. These five made that finding in Shelby County against bipartisan legislation from both houses of Congress, hugely passed on no factual record. They just decided that that was a problem that was over. On no record, with no basis, because it got them to the result that we then saw. What followed? State after state after state passed voter suppression laws. One so badly targeting African Americans that the two courts said it was surgically tailored to get after minority voters. And gerrymandering, the other great control. Bulk gerrymandering, where you go into a state like the Red Map Project did in Ohio and Pennsylvania, and you pack Democrats so tightly into a few districts that all the others become Republican majority districts. And in those states, you send a delegation to Congress that has a huge majority of Republican members, like 13-5, as I recall, in a state where the five, the party of the five, actually won the popular vote. You've sent a delegation to Congress that is out of step with the popular vote of that state, and court after court figured out how to solve that, and the Supreme Court said, nope, 5-4 again, nope, we're not going to take an interest in that question. In all these areas where it's about political power for big special interests and people who want to fund campaigns and people who want to get their way through politics without actually showing up, doing it behind donors' trust and other groups, doing it through these schemes, over and over and over again, you see the same thing. 80 decisions, Judge Barrett. 80 decisions, an 80-0 sweep. I don't think you've tried cases, but some cases.
Ouch.
The issue is bias and discrimination. And if you're making a bias case, as a trial lawyer, Lindsey Graham is a hell of a good trial lawyer. If he wanted to make a bias case, Dick Durbin's a hell of a good trial lawyer. If they wanted to make a bias case and they could show an 80-0 pattern, A, that's admissible, and B, I'd love to make that argument to the jury. I'd be really hard-pressed to be the lawyer saying, no, 80-0 is just a bunch of flukes. All 5-4, all partisan, all this way. So something is not right.
It's like the end of a murder mystery.
And dark money has a lot to do with it. Special interests have
a lot
to do with it. Donors' trust and whoever's hiding behind donors' trust has a lot to do with it. And the Bradley Foundation orchestrating its amici over at the court has a lot to do with it. So I thank you, Judge Barrett, for listening to me now a second time. And I think this gives you a chance for you and I to tee up an interesting conversation tomorrow. And I thank my colleagues for hearing me out.
Thank you, Senator Whitehouse. Senator.
Yeah, Colonel MAGA in the billiard room with the knife. That was masterful. That was that. That's what statesmanship looks and sounds like. And now I imagine Precious Lindsay will try to come back and say, well, there's a dark money group for the Democrats, too. Well, thank you, Charlene. Charlene said, I made that contribution in Sheldon Whitehouse's honor. He used to be our AG. And I'll bet you he was a damn fine one, too, because he still remembers how to try cases, and he knows what putting together a damning piece of a damning evidence presentation looks and sounds like. There's nothing, after what he said today, there's really nothing left to say about this phony baloney bullshit sham of a hearing. That's it. That's it. I hate to say it, but I will, says Darlene in Connecticut. Ames kept nervously clearing her throat as White House gave his masterclass. Two, I could have sworn I saw Ames cross herself, sign of the cross on her forehead at one point, so which lie was that for? Three, Ames seemed to imply that she and Jesse actually planned their family. Oops. A tacit admission that she used birth control? Four, although laudable that Ames and Jesse adopted two clearly lovely children from Haiti, I can't help but see it as a parallel to the Kavanaugh immunization trick or kit. You know how Brat made a big deal of his coaching middle school-aged girls in basketball. That was done to inoculate him from his sexual proclivities with women. I want to see the Federalist Society's kit. I want to see their playbook for becoming a U.S. Supreme Court justice. And that's exactly what I was talking about earlier. No. She wasn't lying. Ames wasn't. Trump didn't tell her what to do. She didn't tell Trump what she'd do. None of the senators, Josh Hawley included, had to ask her if she would overturn Roe v. Wade. She's been planning this all her life, or all her adult life. And everything is understood on a handshake and a nod and a wink. Or maybe a secret lodge high sign or something. Everybody knows what she's there to do. And there's no attempt to hide it. Because in the end, this is just a blunt force, brute usage of political power to try to drive freedom in America back into the shadows. To destroy loving marriages with adopted children, where both partners happen to be same sex. Remember, she sat on the board of a private religion school that refused to educate children of single parents. This is about everything that we value from about 1933 forward. This is about every struggle that has brought people into the streets to lay everything on the line for a better future. This is climate change. This is environmentalism. This is marriage equality. This is bodily autonomy. This is life and death for millions of Americans. And maybe we don't often enough acknowledge that there is a segment of our country, our fellow citizens, who would as soon kill us as look at us. Black, white, gay, straight, cis, trans, male, female. As long as we are standing for each other, there is a significant portion of this country, the citizens thereof, who would as soon kill us as look at us. Because to look at us is to be reminded for them of everything they hate and despise. So that's the program. I was a little late to the air, but I think we made up for it. Hopefully I'll be on time tomorrow. Thanks again to everybody who jumped in to knock the fundraising down a little bit, a lot. We're down to $90 or so. We'll add that in tomorrow for prayer meeting Wednesday. Although I don't think praying's got much to do with what's coming at us. Billable Rick says, murder mystery? Unfortunately, the victim of the murder mystery is the American justice system and the American people. Ouch! Yeah, it is. Oh, and yeah, well, of course, it wouldn't have been a hearing. Apparently, after Sheldon Whitehouse put on his masterclass, Marsha, goodness, Blackburn, said, well, George Soros funds the Antifa. George Soros, no. And George Soros does not have an 80-0 record because of bought judges and bought cases in the American judicial system at the Supreme Court level. No, hell no, he doesn't. We wouldn't be having this conversation if George Soros had that much power. Because Donald Trump, by God, would not be president. Marsha, Marsha, Marsha. Oh, my nose. So, thanks, y'all. Thanks to all of our subscribers. Gosh, we need more subscribers. Thank you to everyone who keeps the program on the air. Patreon, PayPal, a la carte. Thank you. Thank you to all of you who share your precious finite time engaging in the program in whatever manner you so choose. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to Sparky and Steve in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Brand new Malloy on the way, 9 p.m., headon.live. Headon.live is the best place to catch the Malloy program. Thanks, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, whiterosesociety.org. I think Ben's got the podcast all straightened out at White Rose. We shall see after I upload. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, 20 plus years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. Coal River Mountain Watch is proud to be one of the organizations that these judicial thugs spend money trying to destroy. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Stay home if you can. Stay safe. I saw a breaking story over the course of the program that I didn't get around to that bears mentioning. Horrifying. Via the Washington Post, more than 20 states reported record numbers of new coronavirus cases in recent days as experts fear the cold weather second wave. It's not over. The headline at Washington Post says the next wave could be here. Cases are rising again, especially in Midwestern states. Stay home if you can. Stay safe. Do everything you can. If you have to be out and about, wear your mask. If you got a mask that takes filters, change your filters regularly. Wear your mask, wear your gloves, wash your hands, carry hand sanitizer with you. Don't touch your face. Don't be like white supremacist adjacent illegitimate Florida Governor Ron Monkey Up DeKlantis, who only became governor through the efforts of real live, no kidding, Nazis, and get caught on video shaking hands and LARPing and smolicking and lollygagging and grabulating all over everybody, and then going for a pick and a dig and wiping your nose and sticking it in your pocket. Pocket bug. Oh, there went dinner in the Pacific Daylight Time Zone. Too bad. No, don't do that. Keep your social distance. Don't go to any maggot rallies. Make it 10 feet, 13 feet, 16 feet, 20 feet if you possibly can. Just don't get near people if you want to survive this thing. And if somebody comes towards you and says, well, I just got me a margarita and a Darvon, and I don't need no old dang negative COVID test. I don't need one. Avoid Lindsay like the plague. Because he is. Later.